Hello, everyone, and welcome to Weekly Manga Recap here on November the 23rd of 2016. I am Nick. This is Chris. We're going to talk about manga today. What's going on, man?
It's not going great, Nick. We're recording this the day before Thanksgiving, obviously, so, to be expected, there's some anticipation that sometimes your holidays can get ruined. Small things, generally, but things can put a bump in the road, so to speak, mm-hmm. if you know what I'm saying. So, I get the news today. My brother comes up to me and he says, "Hey, they were out of turkey breast of giant. I got a ham instead." And I started laughing. Like, I'm like, "Ha ha ha, 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 what a hilarious joke that you ruined Thanksgiving before it even happened." And to the point I was basically like Robert De Niro's character from Cape Fear. Like, I just have a cigar and I'm like, "Ha ha ha, ha, ha." You got the goddamn turkey though, right? he got a ham. So we're eating ham for Thanksgiving and I don't even know why I bother, basically. It's tragic. Tragedy, Nick. It's a real tragedy. But you know what lifts my spirits?
What?
JoJo's Bizarre Adventure.
It's part three of our ongoing series of looking at the entire series chapter by chapter of JoJo's Bizarre Adventure. And this is a pretty big one. Stardust Crusaders. This is what most people associate with JoJo's Bizarre Adventure as a whole. It's what, it's the one that people like, they got a lot of recognition. It started a lot of the trends that carried on through the rest of the series.
It was also the most pervasive of it because it mm-hmm. was the, one of the only ones to get a game of it, like that made mm-hmm. it, pass international waters and things like that. It's the only version that Viz originally translated and released. Mm-hmm. For a long time, it was the only part with any kind of anime adaptation to it.
Yep.
It's the one where a lot of influences came in other series or media that took pieces of it for things. Like there's a fighter in SNK based off of Polnareff, and there's plenty of Castlevania Easter eggs to JoJo Stand, to Star Platinum and things like that. So this is probably the main part of JoJo's Bizarre Adventure, because this is the part that I think you can point to and most people of a group are going to know what you're talking about if it's JoJo's Bizarre Adventure. Like, this is the most notable part of it, you could say.
And, got that more recent anime adaptation that everyone took the to-be-continued thing from. When you think of JoJo's, generally speaking, you think of this.
Yes.
It's got Dio in it, so.
It has Dio, it has Jotaro, it has a supporting cast. It's probably the most fun of all the JoJo parts. It's significant for a lot of reasons. I want to get your perspective on this, because this was the first part I read. I read part three because, mm-hmm. as I mentioned, this was the only part of JoJo that had been originally translated by Viz. Now they've done parts one and two, and I think they plan to go into parts four and beyond possibly. But for the time, they had only done part three. So that's how I got introduced into the JoJo's franchise. That's how I got started reading it. And then I kind of read the other parts in like this weird piecemeal fashion from there. But for you, because of these recommendations, you started with part one, gone to part two, and you've been following chronologically. So this is all new stuff for you.
Yeah, but I mean, I knew more stuff about part three than any of the rest of JoJo. Partially because of the stands, partially because Jotaro is probably the most recognized out of the protagonists from the series, and also in big part because Dio's role in this chapter of the story is so famous, mm-hmm. so mimetic.
Yes.
With just the sounds that he makes, the steamroller, Zawarudo, all those different things. Exactly. Well, he was doing that in part one, but
yeah, but he didn't have like the badass like hunching your back, right. Like
in the muscle shirt. Yeah,
with his heart headband and fucking heart knee pads.
Why do you have those?
Well, it's
because I'm a JoJo character.
Well, it's kind of interesting in its own way. Of all the parts of JoJo's Bizarre Adventure, you know, it's JoJo's Bizarre Adventure, and the bizarre part of the name is not to be misunderstood. But by and large, I would say Part 3 is the least bizarre of all the parts.
It's very straightforward.
Yeah, like the plot isn't all that absurd, most of the main characters aren't that wacky, and even Dio himself isn't, like, he's eccentric, but considering...
He's a lot less eccentric than he was in Part 1, though.
Yeah, and considering the villain in the next part has a fetish of hands, where he likes to carry around dismembered women's hands and date them... Dio doesn't have that sort of, like, weird gimmick to him or anything like that. So, yeah, like, the stuff of, like, the headband and stuff like that, those are the parts that, like, you're like, oh, that's kind of weird, but you're like, no, it's JoJo's Bizarre Adventure. This is just the part that's not as weird as the rest.
And it's kind of strange that, yeah, maybe that's also part of it, is that it's so straightforward that it's... easier for people to get into right off the bat. Mm-hmm. And because of the way that the different chapters of JoJo are divided so cleanly with a different protagonist each time, even though, you know, Joseph shows up in this one, he's a main character in it. But you don't need to know anything about Part 2 because they don't reference anything from Part 2. It's just that, you know, he's gotten married and he's, you know, he has a grandkid. And now he's going along with his grandson on this adventure in an attempt to save his daughter's life. He barely uses Hamon at all. He does use it, especially when they start fighting with Dio. But, you know, you don't need to know about the way that Hamon works in it or anything like that.
You don't need the
There's no complicated explanation. You know, all the stuff where they would inject it into different objects and stuff and play around with it. Well, that's all gone because it's so much easier and more fun to just have a stand that can do pretty much whatever the fuck you want. and that's even that part of it isn't explored an incredible amount in this chapter yet. Because from what you've told me, things get way weirder.
Yeah, because it's interesting. At the start of this is when stands get introduced to the franchise, which mm-hmm. become essentially a staple of the franchise going forward. You know, some parts try to hide them a little bit more than others, but inevitably everything comes back to stands, no matter how they implement them. But with this was the introduction stands, which are essentially like psychic energy spirit, like manifestations of your mind that have special mm-hmm. abilities, the origins of which have never been fully explained. They explain it a little bit, that it might have something to do with, like, a meteorite that came to Earth, and I think even that starts to get really extrapolated upon later, but the idea being that these ghosts, these spirits, these, you know, psychic embodiments, whatever they are, can essentially do anything depending on whatever their power may be. But in Part 3, where they're first introduced, the first ones you introduce is, like, this one's super fast and strong. This one shoots fire. This one can shoot crystals. This one's a bunch of thorns. This one's also very fast.
This one has a sword.
Yeah, you're
this
like...
This one has a sword.
This one controls sand. And then, like, if you just skip a little bit forward into Part 4, you're like, oh, this stand is a bunch of food that digs itself into other food, and when you eat it, it rejects all of your bad body parts to regrow them with new good ones. And you're like, okay, there was a little bit of a jump there. But yeah, like, you actually even see it as the series goes on, where some of the stands start off kind of simple, but even by the end, they've started to get a little bit more interesting. Like, DC, I believe is his name, Adase, who is the guy who has the stand that if you stand in its shadow, it de-ages you slowly. Mm-hmm. Until you basically become like a fetus. And it's like, okay, right. These are some more interesting ideas and things like that out there.
Even some of the later, tarot group, start to get a little bit weirder, like Death 13 attacks you in your dream. Justice, if you get wounded at all, it can turn you into a puppet. But yeah, at the beginning, it's just, well, mine is stronger in the water, so I will pull you into the water and fight you there where I have the advantage.
Yeah.
It's It's like, well, that's okay. I mean, it's not bad, but...
But it's you know, even with its simplicity, what I love about the JoJo franchise is there's usually innovative ways to solving the conflict. Like, you've now seen it. Because you've read part three, now I can at least start to, like, talk about this in a bit more in depth. Most of the fights in JoJo aren't fights per se. They're more like, almost like murder mysteries or something like that. Like, I have to solve what this guy's stand is.
I have to figure out what the, I have to figure out the boss's weak point.
Yeah. And it's like, I have
weakness
to find
the in
user.
The stand strategy.
Cause nine times out of ten, when they actually get to interact with one another, it's a pretty quick fight from there, usually.
Because JoJo's just got this ridiculous super punchy power that will kill you in an instant.
But, like, that's kind of where the fun of JoJo is it's not like my superpower spirit is stronger than yours necessarily. A lot of the times, it's using ingenuity or creative thinking to essentially overcome your opponent. I forget which one he uses it against, but JoJo's trying to find out who the stand user is, so he makes a comment about how tobacco smoke will make your nose itch. Aaron.
Right.
That's like, basically catches the attention.
So I smoked this cigarette to see which of you would react to it.
Yeah, and one dude's like, oh, and he's like, gotcha, boom! But like, that's,
you fucking idiot, I was bluffing!
But that's the fun of it, is that it's not just like as simple as like, my guy's super fast, so thus I'll just beat you outside of the water. It's like, hey, a lot of the times they have to kind of think of a way to get around these guys, or you know, plan, and then defeat them at their own game. And it comes to some really interesting fights out of that.
One of my favorite moments in the series is when they are being attacked by the user of the sun. And they're in the desert. And they're like, oh my god, it's so freaking hot out here. And, you know, Jonathan looks down at his... Not Jonathan, Joseph looks down at his watch. And it's like, what the fuck? It's 8 o'clock at night. Why is the sun still blazing over us? And then they realize, like, that's not the real sun. It's the stand, the sun. And so they, like, end up digging themselves to the ground to try and escape this horrible heat, because it's just this raging fireball above them. And they're like, where could the stand user be? It can't be, you know, like, they can't be very far away, because this is a very powerful stand. They have to be close by in order to use this. And so looking around, eventually, like, three of them all just start laughing, and one of them's like, what the fuck are you guys laughing at? And they're like, well, that rock over there, see, it's exactly like that rock over there, except it doesn't have a shadow, which means it's a mirror. And so JoJo just takes a rock and throws it really hard through the mirror and knocks the guy out.
And I love it, as they're walking away, they're like...
It's a two-chapter struggle against this guy. The first one, they're trying to escape the sun. The second one, they knock the guy out immediately.
I like it, because as they're walking away, they're like, the sun, what a powerful stand, but we actually never found out who the user's name was. And it actually only came out in like an art book later on. The dude's name is Arabia Fats, so...
There's a lot of characters that don't get named in this story. Like the runaway girl. What's her name?
What's her purpose?
She shows up in like 20 different chapters, and she's just kind of like this character who's just around so that, you know, there can be a vulnerable member of the group who occasionally crushes on JoJo.
Yeah, it's actually something that I think Arake has been trying to do and doesn't really executed until a little bit. Part four kind of has Koichi, who fills that role a little bit, but just like the younger, smaller tag-along character, because you also think of Smokey in part two, who didn't really do anything, but it also kind of filled that role initially at the start, where it's like, I'm the young character who like looks up to the JoJo character, and I want to be as cool as he is. And yeah, they don't name the runaway girl. She just shows up for a little bit, gets picked on by a really creepy orangutan.
She shows up like three different times though, and she never gets a name.
And then she just, like, they send her on her way back to home, and that's it. Like, she doesn't show up again. And I'll spoil it for you. She doesn't show up at any of her future parts, Nick. Like, she never pops up again. So she's just this weird enigma for like 15 chapters.
Because they made a note in like the character guide at the beginning of the series, like, each of the Joestar men have only loved one woman. I'm like, is she supposed to be like JoTro's love interest? No. Because he's too much of a badass to be held down by one woman.
And I'll note, that line is a total piece of horseshit, by the way.
Absolutely.
I guess one thing to mention about this is the first big jump in protagonists, because with the past two parts, it's essentially only been like one or two major characters, whereas this, it's a major group of six characters. Some more important than others, but they all have their own distinct stance, their own distinct personalities, looks. Like, they all usually get their own fights. I think everybody has at least one fight under their belt at some point in the series. And it's a, I think pound for pound against all the other supporting casts in JoJo, this one's my favorite, because everyone in it is a lot of fun. They're all unique, they're all silly or serious, but never too far in any one direction. Like, Jotaro is the badass. He is the stoic, cool guy. But even though Kakyon is also kind of like the cool guy dude, he doesn't have to go too much further than JoJo. He could be a little bit weirder or a little bit more, like, strange to kind of help fill out the archetype a little bit. And they actually do feel like friends, because this is a essentially a cross-global assassination mission that these guys are on. And they
Keep getting targeted by assassins while they're doing it.
And they do start to really feel like a group of friends that have bonded over these various adventures with one another. And there's just so many fun moments between them. Like, you have old man Joseph running around screaming, "Oh my God!" and "Holy shit!" everywhere. And you have Polnareff being just a complete idiot.
Such a goober he is.
But, like, they're all lovable in their own ways. Like, even Iggy, the dog, who is a complete dickhead, who just bites your face then farts in your mouth afterwards. Like, they all have these endearing moments to them, and they're such a whole bunch of fun. I love the main six characters in this.
By the time you get to the end, and of course, like with every JoJo series, some of the main cast members get killed off, but it really feels like it's a big loss when they do get killed, because they've grown so close over the course of this journey. And, you know, keep in mind that other than Abdul and Joseph, none of the characters knew each other before the start of the series.
Yeah.
Joseph is distant from his grandson and ends up meeting him in order to explain what the stands are and what it means. It means that Dio has returned. So that means they're in danger, of course. But Kakyoin and Polnareff, after the three of them set up, they encounter those two independently as well. So only two out of the five people knew each other at all before the start of it. And by the end, it feels, and even actually by about a third of the way through, it feels like they're really close to each other.
Yeah, there's... go ahead.
Well, you know, because they're complete strangers, and then you have points where they're just goofing around together, and just being really casual around each other. They've opened themselves up to each other. And there's also a point where one of the weirder stand users, Death 13 again, Kakyoin is the only one who believes that he is a stand user, because he's a baby. A baby with fangs for some reason. I thought it meant he was a vampire. He never demonstrates vampiric abilities. He's just got fangs because he's a creepy baby with
just
a stand.
A dickhead baby, yeah.
Yeah. Who, of course, you know, like, there's this woman who's like, "Oh, yes, this baby needs to get taken to a hospital. Can you go take him with you on your journey?" And they're like, "Yes, okay, we'll do that." And so Kakyoin eventually realizes, as he's getting attacked in his dream, that baby's a stand user! And he's like, "Guys, the baby's a stand user! We've got to kill him! What are you talking about? He's just a baby!" "Cut it out, Kakyoin, you're being completely hysterical! Stop it!" And it feels, when that happens, like, oh, they don't believe him. They don't want to kill the baby on his words.
That's actually one of the things I also really love about JoJo as a series, is this is the first part that introduces stands, and even within this first part, Arake completely breaks the rules of what, like, initially was set up. Like, you're introduced to stands, they're all ghosts that, like, come out of the body in humanoid forms and have specific powers. And, like,
Joseph says they're called stands because they stand beside you. That is a crock of bullshit.
And then, like, within three stands, it's like, oh, this stand is a giant fucking battleship controlled by a pervert, horny orangutan. And you're like, okay, like, let's just go with it.
They just end up going on this abandoned battleship. They're like, where the hell is the crew? And the runaway girl is like, I'm going to get naked and take a shower.
She's like,
and your auntie's like,
I better go take a shower real quick. Like, really? That's the first thing you want to do? All right, whatever.
There is, speaking of this battleship, there is just a running gag in the series that all their modes of transportation get lost within one fight. By the time that they finally get in their submarine and then it crashes and Palpron is like, why do all of our vehicles get destroyed like this? And I'm like, Jesus Christ, you guys are, how much money does Joseph have?
It's that Speedwagon Foundation, Nick.
That Speedwagon Foundation is really helpful. Because they start off by taking a charter flight. They're like, okay, we've got to go to Egypt. Let's just take a charter flight there. And, of course, the Tower of Grey has hijacked the ship and attacks them all. So that one gets taken down. Okay, well, let's rent a boat. Well, the captain's been replaced by the user of Dark Blue Moon. Well, shit, that one didn't work. He crashed the ship. This battle cruiser came by. Oh, no, that was actually the Strength. That was a stand controlled by Horny Orangutan. Okay, we washed up on shore. All right, well, let's get some camels to trick across the desert. God damn it, the camels are dead now. Okay, let's get in this submarine. Let's get in this submarine and go undersea, and that way they won't be able to find us. God damn it, the High Priestess got on the submarine. Okay, let's take a helicopter.
It's so much fun, though, of just watching their constant, like, battering that happens as they encounter another stand user who's just around to fuck up their day. And even a lot of the stand battles in this part are really memorable, too, because there's a lot of just, like, goofy users. Ebony Devil, I believe. It's his stand grows more powerful the more he hates you. So you think it'd be like, oh, well, he has to have, like, a long-standing grudge against one of the members. No, he intentionally pisses off the most volatile member of the group before they, like, reveals his stand, so that Polnareff just beats the shit out of him, and he's like, that fucking Polnareff, now I'll kill him! And then he stands his stand after him. And I'm like, that is awesome! It's like, my stand needs to hate him. I'll get my shit kicked in by him first. That'll do it.
And then there's a... I forget how it is. Where is it? There's a moment where it's the High Priestess. That's the one that attacks them on the submarine. The High Priestess has this ability where it can imitate anything that's made of mineral. They're, of course, in this confined space, and, you know, it'll turn into one of the dials, or it'll turn into a cup that they've got sitting on the counter. And every time that they're trying to find it, it gets a sneak attack on them. So eventually they're like, let's seal the submarine, and we'll just abandon it, and we'll take the scuba gear, and we'll leave. So Polnareff starts to put his on, and of course the mouthpiece for his scuba gear is the High Priestess, and it goes into his mouth. And they're like, oh no, it's going to tear apart his internal organs. And so Kakioid and Joseph just send their stands in through his nose to grab it.
this is what becomes JoJo, though, for so much of the series, is you're just like, God damn, this is some dedication to winning this fight. Because you didn't just give up when you're like, that's gross, that's weird. You're like, no, I'm just going to shove my stand down your nose and we're going to save you.
We're going to do some fantastic journey by shrinking our stands down to fight the thing that's infiltrated your brain.
So I guess it would be a good time to talk a bit about the characters themselves, because we mentioned a little bit in kind of like a general sense, but like going through them, who were your favorite stand or JoJo characters this time around?
That's hard to say, honestly. The thing that I'm noticing about JoJo is that characters aren't really complex.
No.
It's just, they're very identifiable, though. Very immediately identifiable in terms of how their attitude kind of rings with you. You know, the motivations in this are like, you know, I was attacked by Dio and I want to get my revenge on him. My sister was killed by a stand user under Dio's leadership, and so I want to get my revenge. My mother is going to die if I don't defeat Dio, so I've got to go and defeat him. And so many of the characters are so stoic that they really just kind of only ring slightly differently, if you understand what I mean.
Oh, no, I agree.
A lot of them are very, like, nonplussed about a bunch of stuff. Or if something is really shocking, then just kind of react in the same form of shock. They don't feel incredibly distinct from each other. So that's why it's kind of hard to say exactly which one I like over the others. But I do have to say that Polnareff really did kind of did appeal to me. Because he's such a loser, but he's such a good guy deep down. He's selfish and cowardly and pathetic so much of the time, but he'll come through for you in the clutch. So I did really like him, but I like every character, honestly.
What helps is that everyone has their chances to shine and to save the day. In particular at the end, because this is one of the higher death counts for a JoJo series in terms of the main cast. Essentially, like, half of the main cast is dead by the end of this. And almost all of them basically go out in a big self-sacrifice. Like, nobody's loss is, like a death in a slasher film or something like that. Like, just a body on the floor. Like, a lot of them usually have a point to the fact that, and this is, I guess, a slight spoiler. If you are interested in checking out JoJo and you didn't want to know any spoilers, you know, then stop listening now, because I think from here on in there are probably going to be some spoilers. But with Kakyon, that death in particular has so much weight to it, because you saw how in those last moments his only thought was, how can I tell? I figured out what Dio's stand is. How do I tell everybody what it is?
And because seeing, I've had a fist put through my goddamn stomach, and I can't talk.
But then seeing his action, what he did do in that, and then how Joseph starts dissecting it, because he's like, why would he fire? Why did he miss? And then he's like, no.
Why would he launch his attack at a freaking clock?
Yeah, he wouldn't do that unintentionally. He had a reason for it, and he's figured out. And it speaks to the camaraderie and trust that's been formed between them all, that he's like, I know that these guys are definitely working together. Like, I know that these guys are like a team, and that they're, you know, they have a real connection to one another. So I think in the same way it makes Kakyon's sacrifice really cool, because it shows just how far he's willing to go, it also makes it a lot sadder, because you're like, oh, this guy really was like a good friend to all of these guys. And it's kind of sad, because, you know, he had a family too at home. It's not like he was just he was a student of or a classmate of JoJo's. Like, he presumably had a mom and everything like that. So,
well, he specifically is like thinking to himself as he's dying, like, I'm sorry, mother and father, I wonder what you're up to right now. Probably just getting ready for bed. Don't even know what's happening to me. But then, you know, you get the narration, but his last thoughts were not of his mother and father, but of how he had to communicate the secret of Dio's stand. I really like his stand, too, for some reason.
Hair
I don't know what it is.
Hair elephant green.
Yeah. It's, I don't know, it's, I just like the design of it and how it uses crystals. I don't know.
It's kind of an interesting stand, too, because, like, all the other ones are a little bit more blunt in what they're meant to do, but his has a lot more versatility.
Magician's Red, it shoot fire. Star Platinum, punch fast. The weirdest one of the main cast, I think, is definitely Hermit Purple, though. That's such a weird thing. I was trying to figure out what is it? Like, the Thorns interact with electronics somehow?
He can see.
And if I chop my head, and if I crush a camera like this, I can take a picture of something miles away. How did you come across that ability?
Like, it's just him, like, on his daily usual Polaroid karate chapping hobby. And he's like, that took a picture of something I wasn't there for. I have powers!
And then he reveals later he can just, like, hack into a TV and he could, like, have a video feed of it and says, like, why don't you just do that instead? Because he knows, like, the price of the freaking camera that he's going to crush every time. He's got to crush a really expensive camera for it to work.
Yeah, it's one of the weirder ones, though I believe it probably had something to do with, because he was a Hamon user, because they wanted to make him older, Arky didn't want to give him, like, a punchy punch kind of stand.
Right.
So, it does kind of fit with him. It's
He's got to have a utility power, because we've got to have a powerful stand and Hamon. Like, well, why doesn't Joseph just go kill Dio?
And I think it's actually kind of fun, too, is that they managed to rework Joseph into this story in a way that his role is completely shifted from part two. He's not the protagonist, but he is still Joseph from that part, just you could see that he's become more of an adult, quote-unquote. Like, he's still an immature fuck. But you could tell that this is a guy who's had a daughter, who has grandkids, who's traveled the world. Like, he's not the same guy he was in Part 2. Yet he still has, like, the integral things that make him Joseph. Like, the gimmick he pulls at the very end where he pretends that Dio has taken over his body. And Jotaro's like, I'm going to have to kill you. He's like, I know, it's a joke.
It's like, why would you do that? You literally just came back from the dead. It's like, I will kill the Joestar.
I'm just a joke.
Stupid old man.
But no, I really like Polnareff. He's fun. I like Abdul a lot. I think he's an underrated character. He doesn't have as much to do, and he's not as he doesn't have as much like personality as some of the other characters. But I thought he filled his role really well as being like kind of the more stoic, level-headed member of the team who has his big moments. But also it's just kind of nice seeing a character of Egyptian origin in a manga that isn't like played for like a goofy stereotype or anything like that.
No.
Like, he's just another member of the team and he has a stand that's a firebird and, you know, he'll kick some ass.
And, you know, he plays a mentor role too. And he works as a really good straight man to the rest of the group, honestly. Because he's probably the most serious, even though Jotaro is the one who seems to make, like, the least expressions in the whole thing. He just kind of constantly, just going, you really pissed me off. Did you? Did you really? Because you don't look incredibly mad right now.
I do. Jotaro is a interesting character, because to me he is that personification of just a badass. I went through this when we did that top 10 badasses list, but now you've actually seen the part in question I was referring to, that the gambling DRB the Gambler game, and you're like, wow, he like won this off of just being that like intimidating
giant
a badass
balls.
Just drop them right on the table and the dude's like, I know I've won and yet I give up.
Like. And he's like, and then Jotaro looks out at his cards and he doesn't say something like, I knew I just had to bluff him. He looks at them and is like, wow, I would have definitely lost. What a heart attack if I had looked at those.
He like flips him over. He's like, oh, that hand was garbage.
And I'm just like, what the fuck were you doing? Hey, it worked.
But it's what I think works too is because Jojo and the things he goes through don't feel like, it doesn't feel like they're like, well, he does it because he's Jojo. I feel like it's like established enough early on and he actually does have to do something. Like, you know, I'll point out time and time again that fight that Erza had in Fairy Tail where she won, quote unquote, literally because she's Erza. Like, that's what the characters right. use as a justification. That's not really what Jotaro has per se. Like, he's more of just somebody who's established himself as having like this much of like a badass aura to him and is just like fighting all of his life. Like he fights the guy who de-ages you. And if he de-ages you to the point where you wouldn't have your stand anymore, you don't have it. So he gets Jotaro to the point where he's de-aged him to like 11 years old or whatever, so he doesn't have his stand, and he's like, now I'll kick your ass, completely forgetting that Jotaro at 11 years old was still just a badass and just still beats the shit out of him just with his regular kid body, and you're like, oh, that's fucking awesome. Also, Jotaro's hat has no back, and that still fucks with my mind. I don't understand how that thing exists.
It was a lot more clear to me in looking at the manga art, though, because I can tell that it didn't just, like, turn into his hair like it appears to in the anime. It just kind of blends in really well.
Well, it's more noticeable.
It is really strange the way that you can't tell where it ends, though.
Well, the thing that's really weird is in Part 4, because he shows up again later on. He's actually the most prevalent JoJo throughout the entire franchise. In Part 4 and onwards, when he shows up, he's wearing a white version of the outfit he's wearing. So it's a white hat that just suddenly stops and becomes hair at some point. So, somewhere out there, they need to do a death battle between Jotaro and Adebisi from Oz into how the fuck does this hat stay on this person's head contest. I don't know who would win. That'd be a really tough contest.
Yeah, Jotaro's just got this weird presence about him. He's kind of like Bender, honestly. Where he just don't give a fuck.
Yeah.
You're introduced to him at the beginning. And he's in jail. And he's in jail because he's like, I need to stay in here because I've got a dangerous spirit that's following me around. So I can't be trusted around other people. And all the other prisoners are terrified of this high school kid. I mean, he's a Joestar, so he's freaking giant. But they're terrified of this high schooler. Then later on we see him just at school. He's got all these girls just throwing themselves at him. Just like, I am here, take me. No, get out of the way, you bitch, take me instead. He does little things to acknowledge them, and they freak out over it. It's like, ah, you look at me, you know. And meanwhile, Jotaro is just like, get out of the way, you freaking idiots. You're wasting my time, bothering me. Ah.
He is. He's so, like, it's like in his own mind, he's like, God, I fucking hate all of you. You're all so annoying to me. And it's not because he's, like, a bad person or anything like that. They just annoy him. His catchphrase is, oh, what a bother. Like, come on. This is going to be bothersome. It's like, it's such a great catchphrase with the way he, like, delivers it. Like, yada, yada, does it. But you're like, every time this dude's like, oh, what a headache. Badass, badass, punch, 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 punch. I think some of those moments, though, that make JoJo are, like, the contrast to that. Like, we see all those moments where he's easily annoyed or being stoic. But the moments where he, like, gets to snap are some of my favorites. One of my favorite moments of this, and this is one of my favorite moments of manga, period, is when they encounter the stand, the lovers. And it's basically like a control stand. This guy puts his stand inside of Joseph, and any pain that the stand user feels, Joseph will then experience 10 times or something like that. So if Jotaro tries to punch him, then Joseph feels that 10 times. So this guy basically has control over JoJo. He's like, you can't hurt me or I'll, like, break my face and, you know, kill your grandpa or whatever. So he basically just makes Jotaro his bitch for a while. Like, come with me, carry all my shopping bags, like, lick my fucking shoes, like, all that stuff. They finally get the lovers out of Joseph, and when they tell that to Jotaro, he proceeds to full page spread punch the living shit out of this guy for 3 straight pages. It's so awesome when you just flip to the next page, like, he's still doing it. Oh man, he's still kicking this dude's ass.
Well, and before that point, because, you know, the guy's done stuff like, you know, they go into, like, a jewelry store. And he says, hey, steal that bracelet for me using your stand. And then he's like, hey, this guy's stealing stuff. And he gets beaten up by the people in the store. He's like, don't use your stand on them or I'll hurt myself and hurt your grandfather. So Jotaro just has to let them beat him up and kick him out. Then, yeah, he makes Jotaro act as a human bridge and he steps on his hand. He makes him shine his shoes. And meanwhile, Jotaro is, like, keeping this list. And the guy says, what is that? And Jotaro is like, I'm just writing down everything that you've done to me so that I can pay it back to you. And then at the end, after, of course, the lovers has been defeated, Jotaro beats the shit out of the guy and then throws the list at him and is like, and here's your receipt.
I fucking... Also, by the way, this guy, the stand user's name was Steely Dan. Because in this JoJo universe, usually the stands are the ones that get the musical names, but in part 3 they were initially introduced as tarot cards, and then later on they became Egyptian gods until they even ran out of things for that, and then they finally just had to go with, like, musical acts. But the characters themselves often get musical acts. Polnareff, for example, is one. Abdul is even one, after Paula Abdul. But also included in this part, Kenny G, Vanilla Ice, Oingo Boingo, Pet Shop, a whole bunch of them are in there, and they're so goofy and fun. The way that Vanilla Ice is one of the most terrifying fucking antagonists in the JoJo series. He is a fucking monster. And you're just like, this is awesome. This is fucking great. I love this. Ooh, Hall Horse! I completely forgot to mention Hall Horse. He's one of the most fun parts of Part 3 for me, because he's dick.
Such a goober. He's the Poltergeist of the bad guys.
Yeah, he's the Zonge of the JoJo universe, except he unfortunately does get his just desserts eventually. But it's just like, he's such a goofball that keeps getting to show up at points. You're just like, he gets like a fifth bite at the apple eventually. You're just like, God damn you, dude, I have to admire this perseverance, because after the first two times, I'd have just been like, fuck this stand nonsense. This gun isn't even that cool.
It's really weird because, his stand is the Emperor, which is just, he conjures a gun in his hand and he can control the bullets it shoots, which is useful. But consider the fact that he is teaming up with the user of the Hanged Man, which is a stand that travels between reflective surfaces at the speed of light and can attack you from within the mirror. And of course, you can't hit it if it's in a mirror. You'll just break the mirror. And it's still a reflective surface if you do that. They end up having to do something really cool, which is they control what reflected surfaces it can bounce between and have to attack it in between there. So they have to just, like, be attacking the space between where it's traveling to in the instant that it's moving. And it's more the more terrifying and more difficult foes that they have to defeat in the early part of the series. He partners up with Hull Horse, so...
It's a real power balance curve between the two of them.
So he's like, yo, I can attack you at the speed of light, and you can't. I have a gun.
I can control both. Which is so weird, considering a couple different things about Part 5. Part 5 introduces the concept that there actually is a mirror world, but also Part 5 has another stand user with a gun who can control his bullets, and has a lot more versatility with it. Essentially, so someone gets his gun, but better. And more annoying.
So you're saying that while they were fighting him and they were like, that's ridiculous. There's no such thing as a mirror world. No, we have to think about this scientifically. There actually is a mirror world.
There's another stand user who brings people into the mirror world, but it's an entire fight within Part 5 that I like to think Araki is like, that didn't happen. Because it also introduced a stand. As you'll kind of start to pick up on as time goes on, Araki doesn't always think ahead when he creates some characters. And he oftentimes has to, like, retroactively balance or retcon his own series. And he introduced someone in Part 5 who's, like, one of the main characters whose stand was far too powerful. So he just had to write him out of the story eventually. Like, he just had to be like, this guy doesn't want to go on the adventure anymore. Just leaves. And that's the only fight the dude had is against a guy with the mirror world power. So maybe in his mind he's like, no, that fight never happened. What do you... Stop. It didn't happen. Shut up. Who's Fugo? I don't know who he is. Shut up. But I love that fight you're talking about with Jay Giles. Of the Jay Giles band, of course.
Yeah.
That's a great fight. It's kind of interesting, too.
Love that song.
It's a great one. Weird song, but great. And I like about it is it's a personal fight for Polnareff, because this is the guy who raped and murdered Polnareff's sister, his little sister. And
he has two right hands!
Yeah, that's his signifying mark. And what's kind of, like, interesting is, like, Polnareff, when he joins the group, mentions, like, I want to kill this guy. Like, that's my reason for being part of the group. And it's only, like, three fights later that this guy shows up. Like, it's not, like, a long, ongoing
plot. It's not a long one.
You think that
with a motivation like that, that he would be, like, you know, one of the guardians of Dio's castle or something. But nope.
No, like they find the guy pretty quickly after that, and Polnareff gets his justice and keeps with the group afterwards because he's like, I'm going to help you take down Dio. And it's really satisfying. The fight with Dio in particular, I don't want to jump ahead too
much.
What
the fuck? I just looked up Fugo. It's like, deadly flesh-eating virus that can kill any life form nearby in 30 seconds. He's a hero?
They didn't have much time to extrapolate upon this power, because literally he has one fight in which he introduces the stand, and then never has another one after that, and like, as soon as the first opportunity presents itself afterwards, leaves the group. And I do know that they did a side novel that he does get to do some stuff in, and they actually introduce his power in a more interesting way then, like he actually can fire the disease out to eradicate other diseases and nullify its own disease to prevent other, like, innocent people from being affected by it. So maybe some, like, posthumous rebalancing, but yeah, he just disappears. But to the fight with Dio itself, I found that to be one of the more satisfying, like, final encounters in, like, a manga, because it's this epic battle between Jojo or Jotaro and Dio, but almost everyone plays a significant part in it. Like, I already mentioned Kakyon's sacrifice and how that helps them find out what his stand is. Joseph plays a part in trying to help things out. And even Polnareff, who gets, like, fucking curb stomped by him immediately, shows up to basically give Joseph or Jotaro a brief moment to kind of, like, catch his breath and recover. And there's so, like, just the level of effort these people go to. Because there's a moment where Jotaro's like, Dio's like, I have won. I am victorious. And Jotaro's plain dead. And he's literally clutching his own heart with Star Platinum to keep it from beating so that Dio will believe for certain that he's dead. And Dio is like, I guess he's dead. But perhaps I'll just cut off his head with a stop sign to be sure. And like, Jotaro's like, shoot! And then that's when fucking like Polnareff comes in and like delays him at like just for a moment, and that helps Jotaro get back up and continue their big awesome fight. It's just so awesome.
That is an incredible goddamn final fight. Like, I mean, so much of the series is, I honestly, I'm gonna be kind of blunt about this. I had trouble at times actually getting through this series because it's so episodic. Mm-hmm. You'll get through a fight after a few chapters, and then they just kind of move on to another one. And that's really all there is, you know, they're going on this journey and they're encountering these various assassins that are targeting them. They encounter them usually one at a time, sometimes two. And then after they've defeated one, then they're just going to move on to the next one. And so because of that, it really feels like you can just kind of stop after you've finished one fight for a while. It's not a really big pager, like, this was a cliffhanger, I have to move on to this one. It's just like, well, they defeated that guy.
Yeah.
They're going to fight someone else next time.
It's very Monster of the Week-ish. Like, mm-hmm. it's essentially a fight against the stand user. When it ends, it usually doesn't pick up into the next one or anything like that.
And they're pretty short encounters, too. Usually around 4 to 6 chapters each. So it's, it's the thing that I would do is I would just, take about 10 minutes or so to read one fight and then be like, oh, that was nice. And then just kind of stop for a little while.
Yeah.
Which is great, if you're reading through the series casually, but if you've got to get through, this... like 15 volume chunk. Then wasn't incredibly good for that.
It's a lengthy one, and I think it does improve. Part 4 definitely improves upon it, although part 4 has its own kind of issue with that, in that part 4 lacks a plot at the start, but it's one of those ones where it pays off later on because it's introduced you to all these different characters who get to play more of a role as like the story itself starts to develop. With part 3, it's literally like, start here in Japan, end here in Egypt, and it's just one long point to that. Like, they're just on as straight of a line as they can get to that end point. And there's a lot of fun fights and a lot of really interesting encounters that happen along the way, but that is ultimately what it is. No revelations happen in the plot to make things more deep and interesting. Dio himself doesn't really do anything until the end when
he only really steps out of the shadow, like, right when his fight's about to happen.
Yeah, like, it's not...
He
like,
has a little bit of fun before that, where he just hijacks this senator's car to have a joyride and run people off the sidewalk and then throw the guy's corpse at Joseph and Kakyoin. But...
But, oh, by the way, I need to note that JoJo's Bizarre Adventure is violent as shit. And the series...
Oh, yeah. This part begins with Dio carving a guy's face off.
Like, the first stand battles that happen in the series, Kakyon stabs a woman in the eye with a pen. Like, vividly stabs her in the eye with the pen. And the second Standers that they fight specializes in tearing out people's tongues with, like, a needle pincer. The Death 13 fight will forever be immortalized in my mind for that image of the dog whose face was slashed off with a scythe, and they wake up and see the results of that. It is so graphic and like, oh, why? That it sticks with you. So, fair warning for anybody who can't deal with that kind of squicky stuff. You're going to have to get used to at least some of that. I don't know if the anime fixed up some of that. I don't know if they cut any of that kind of...
Even when Jotaro is going to beat up a guy, he just pummels them to death with this rapid-fire, rock-fisted ghost that will just leave these indentations and break people's bodies. So
yeah, so be forewarned. You got to deal with some graphic brutality. They fixed it by turning them black. Blacked out the blood. I guess that helps a little bit. But
it's a black and white manga.
Yeah, well, the anime, though, adaptation, I was wondering if they altered that at all. I think this is a fun part. It's not my favorite part. I love what this part has. I love a lot of what it represents. I can see why this is the part that got the anime adaptation originally in the Viz translation, because this is far and away the most accessible part of JoJo's Bizarre Adventure. I mentioned before, it's the least bizarre of them. You know, you don't have to have a moment where you explain why does that serial killer walk around with women's hands, or why are they chasing after a guy whose power is to take the memories out of people by making them into a CD drive and then running away with it. You don't have to deal with that sort of wacky shit in this part. There's weirdness to it, but its lead is the most stereotype badass character of the JoJo family. Like, this is the JoJo part that if you read when you're 16, you're like, immediately, like, Jotaro is my favorite because he's Bamf. You know, like, and there's nothing wrong with that. But that's what this part is it's easily the most digestible, consumable part of JoJo.
Yeah.
And as you go through the rest of the series, and even when you read some of the previous parts, you can see that there are some other parts to JoJo, the franchise, that are more enjoyable than necessarily what part three gives you. But part three kind of started a phenomenon in and of itself. Like, they do so many crazy things in it, and it establishes so much of what becomes the series going forward.
Yeah, I really liked it. I do think that it's probably an easier way to get someone to try out JoJo than, well, here's this story about this rich British kid who's super muscular, and his foster brother decides to betray him by writing him out of the family name and killing his father. He does that by using a stone mask to turn into a vampire. And the only way that the British guy can defeat him is if he harnesses the power of the sun to make the water in his body vibrate. And then...
Now, I want to pose this out there because, you know, we thanks once again to Infamous Planet, who created this overlay that you see here. Did you enjoy the transition to stands? Because Infamous very clearly has stated he dislikes it because he doesn't like proxy battles, which JoJo wasn't before. It was Haman users, but he doesn't like the fact that now it's mostly about stands and how it becomes sort of a proxy battle. Did you have any issue with that transition from the Haman battles to stand battles?
No, because honestly, it doesn't really affect the way that the heroes are treated. Like, they're very much in danger whenever stuff is happening. I think that in order to call it a proxy battle, that would necessitate that when something happens to the stand, it doesn't happen to the controller. Mm-hmm. That's the thing, is that they're directly connected. If you harm the stand, you harm the one who controls it. So the visuals get a little bit confusing here and there, where you have to shift suddenly from Star Platinum being attacked to Jotaro feeling the effects of it. But because they fight so directly, the heroes do, I didn't really have a problem with it. Like, a lot of the times whenever you see Joseph use Purple Hermit, it's just purple thorns extending from his hands. You know, whatever. Jotaro having Star Platinum, usually he just has Star Platinum, like, his body just, like, is emerging from him. He's just, you know, throwing hands everywhere directly from out of Jotaro's body anyway. And it adds a little bit of a layer to, okay, the stand user is attacking us and we don't know where they are and their stand is really hard to confront, but if we could just find them, we could probably deal with this. So I think it allows for more flexibility in the setups that you can have. That whole thing with Steely Dan, you couldn't have done that if it were just like, oh, I just have a power, you know?
Yeah.
I think that it allows for the villain to be cowardly or to be direct. You have those options with the same single mechanic.
Yes, definitely.
So, I mean, it didn't bother me because, like, okay, well, it's just a weird way the powers work, so.
Yeah, to me, they're essentially, like, just the mechanic of this universe, the same way, like, Devil Fruits are in One Piece and things like that. What I always loved about stands is the way that Araki uses a very creative touch. Like, even for simple powers, he doesn't go with the simplest results for everything. Like, you know, even though Abdul has fire powers, he doesn't just win every fight by throwing a big fireball at somebody. Like, they have to usually use their head and come up with a better solution. Part 3, sort of, again, it's that weird anomaly that powers are very simple at the start, but as the parts go on and the powers get more and more obtuse, you know, the power to heal things you punch, the power to create life out of the things you hit, the power to turn yourself into string, like, these are the main protagonist powers going forward. And those help to set up really interesting fights because it's just Araki going crazy with his creativity. So I can see why Infamous would dislike it or why people might dislike the shift, because you do go from a series that was about, like, martial arts essentially into a series that's like, now my magic ghost will fight you with its weird power that doesn't seem to have any connection to reality. Like, I get it, but at the same time, it's not a, like, I don't consider it a proxy battle like a Pokemon or Digimon, because, you know, the heroes themselves are the ones still doing the fighting. Plus, it's never made entirely clear, but they acted at the start like stands have a mind of their own, but they rarely ever show it. Like, at the start, Jotaro tries to kill himself, but his stand stops the bullet, like that whole Hulk thing. But
right,
there are only a couple, like a handful of stands going forward that I could even think of where the stand themselves act against the personality of the one using it. So it's not even like a fully developed thing. It's almost as though it's just like, this is my martial arts style to send my psychic ghost who punches things really fast at you. Wah!
Yeah. And, a lot of the time when the villains they're fighting and, you know, the stand user isn't present, so they just have the stand there, they talk through the stand to them. So it's a little bit of a nebulous thing. I'm just thinking of the final fight now, because that's an awesome fight.
It is so great.
It's so weird because it's long, but it feels like there's a reason for it to be long. They don't just focus on, oh, well, now they punch each other with this technique and this technique. It's a series of one-ups and tricks that Dio and Jotaro are playing on each other in order to get the upper hand. And as powerful as Dio is and as intimidating as he has to resort to some dirty-ass, cowardly tactics in order to keep the fight going at times.
We almost finished this without even talking about Dio, who we mentioned, like, he's the salvation of Part 1, because he's so ludicrously evil. He does not appear much in this part. Like, in Part 3, he doesn't really do anything until his final fight happens.
He's just waiting in the shadows for Jotaro and company to come after him, and then he steps out and he's like, all right, time to be awesome for about 20 chapters.
Time to be amazing, motherfuckers. Because he does, he, like, rides around and, like, is just being, just arms crossed, so confident and
it's
so
such a great
douchey.
Moment. There's a great moment where they attack him while he's riding around in the back of this car he's hijacked, because he's forcing the senator that he's bullying around to drive him around. The guy's going crazy because he's so scared of Dio. And they're driving around and the car gets, like, blown from a Hierophant Green attacking them. And, like, half the car is been destroyed. And so the senator's looking behind him, like, what happened? And Dio just goes, do I have anything to gain by explaining myself to you? Keep driving!
And I love it because his power is to stop time. Dio has the power of the world.
The world.
At the start, he could freeze time.
Oh. Pause, by the way. So, in Yu-Gi-Oh! GX,
okay.
There is the villain of the second series, Sayo, uses Arcana Force cards. They're cards based off of the Major Tarot. And, of course, his ace is the world, the highest of the tarot cards. Eventually, he ends up getting, like, even stronger ones than that, but whatever. His ace is the world. And so we had this joke, a few of my friends and I, when we were watching it in the original Japanese, because he would go, Zawarudo, when declaring his attack, and we were like, yeah! You know, so, and I did not realize until we were reading through this that, yeah, there's a tarot gimmick in JoJo 2. So, I was like, oh, okay. I just kind of assumed that his stand was called the world for completely different reasons.
You got to the world before you were like...
No. I realized it in the main, when they're being introduced to...
I was going to say, like, doesn't Abdul say specifically they named him after the tarot?
Mine is the magician, and yours is the star, and the first assassin they encounter is Tower of Grey.
I would love if, like, they first got to Geb, and they're like, Abdul, which one is this? He's like,
Knight of Cups.
The rock dude with water power. Shut up. I'm dead.
I'm dead now. Again.
Goodbye forever.
But yeah, so you're talking about Dio, sorry.
Yeah, but like Dio just is this ridiculous character. He has the power to stop time, and he uses that with such an interesting effect at points, because like the trademark thing he does is he freezes time. Then he throws like seven dozen knives and leaves them hovering in the air right in front of the person. And he just sits there and he's like, oh, this is going to be good. Unfreezes time and then he just slams into the fucking person. And you're like, oh, that's such a fucking awesome move. And he uses that to great effect. And his power just keeps increasing as the fight goes along. And that's like, the danger of it is JoJo's like, holy shit, he's getting stronger. And like, how does
he makes a note? He makes a note during it, like, you know, but when I first discovered this ability, I could only freeze time for an instant, but then it became 1 second, then 2 seconds, and now I can control it for 5 seconds. I can have time completely stopped, which I got to thinking during that fight, like, okay, you can freeze time for up to 5 seconds, but what's to stop you from just freezing it again? Is there a limit to this? Is there a cooldown?
He has to recover from the monologue he goes through while time is frozen for 5 seconds.
And it's such a ridiculous fight because it's this game of wits between them through so much of it. And then at the end, it just ends in the most ridiculously shonen way possible, which is just, I got stronger faster than you did.
For a fight with a guy whose power is to control time, it ends with a like front to front, like punch, like two fists going again. Essentially, it was like the end of the Cell fight in Dragon Ball, like the two energy blasts against each other,
right.
And one just eventually wins, just in fist form. And it's so awesome that it ends that way, because it's like you could have gone goofy or too big in that, and there's something so satisfying about them at one last shot going at each other, and like you see Star Platinum's hands start cracking, and Dio's like, ha ha ha, and then the world starts breaking, he's like, uh oh. But yeah,
like just shatters.
And you mentioned earlier what a coward he is. Like, there's a point where he's like, "Duh, I'm hurt," and then like twists his leg so the blood shoots out and blinds Jotaro. Like, you have the power to stop time, and you're still cheating. You're the best.
Well, like, yeah, he at one point has to run away. He like escapes into this bar because they're fighting through the streets of Cairo while they're fighting. He escapes into a bar to take cover, uses this girl inside as a human shield, and then drains her of blood to recover his strength. He gets wounded really heavily, like, because Jotaro finally just gets this huge shot at him and, like, cracks the side of his skull. And so Dio has to get away, so he just is like, okay, freeze time, crawls forward. And then just to grab onto the back bumper of a car that's speeding by, and then unfreeze time so he starts to get away. And So Jotaro throws a knife at the tire of the car to stop it. He's like, okay, now I'll get into the sewer cover, and Jotaro is still just inside the sewer. And then Jotaro punches him again, and Dio's like, haha, I wanted to do this. Been thrown backwards next to the body of Joseph, whose blood I can drain. And then he just starts freaking out because he's absorbed the Joestar blood and he's starting to gain massive strength, and he feels so good that he just starts clawing at the sides of his head with his, just making himself bleed because he's clawing so much, and then his wounds are immediately healing because he's so much stronger now. And then, yeah, it goes from this ridiculous sequence of Dio being a massive coward, despite the ability to... At first, he's stronger than Star Platinum. He doesn't even need to freeze time to overpower Jotaro, but he's such a cocky shit that he uses it anyway. And then he's mocking Jotaro. He's like, you can't even tell what's going on. Wait a minute. Can you move while I've stopped time?
Oh, that is one of the coolest moments, too, when he realizes Jotaro's, like, able to...
Ha ha ha! You were just... I see, you played a nice little trick on me with that magnet, which somehow worked, I don't know. But now I know that you can't stop that.
Yeah, bam! You know what? We were talking earlier about, like, the issues with this part in particular and, like, how the characters evolve. But, like, that moment right there that we just had is, I think, why I love the JoJo series so much. Because even though you could, like, look at it critically and be like, yeah, there's some problems here, there's some issues here, it's all worth it when you just delve into it and you're like, oh, it was fucking awesome when he did that, right? When he fucking just socks at you in the fucking frozen time. Like, that's what I love about the JoJo franchise. And you know, to sum things up, because we have a lot of manga to talk about today, let's not go too much longer. But the JoJo franchise just has so many wonderful, awesome moments like that just, like, fill you up with so much shonen, like, badass, raw emotion. And again, part 3 is not perfect. It has flaws, and some people won't like the transition to stance, and that's an unfortunate thing because that's the standard going forward.
You're stuck with them.
Yeah, they don't really stop. They try to pretend like they will in part 7, and then he's like, fuck it, we'll just bad stance back in. The whole Jesus thing wasn't working out as well as I hoped. But it has so many great moments to it. Magnificent characters, the steamroller attack, Iggy,
I still don't really
awesome
understand
wonderful.
That. Because he plants the steamroller on him. So Jotaro has to use Star Platinum to try and punch through it. That makes sense to me. I get that. Why is Dio punching it from the other side?
I guess the idea would be that he's, like, trying to be stronger to force the strength down, but the punching aspect works against it. But I don't care, because it is fucking awesome to see them both on the other side. It's like, going fucking crazy. It's awesome. But, like, that's what part 3 is. It's full of so many great, fun moments like that. Really entertaining battles. There's a couple of weird ones in there. There are certainly some fights that even I forgot. I entirely forgot that Anubis, the sword stand, was a thing within part 3. Like, I always forget, like, the god things that come in there. How there was, like, a fucking video game player guy, or that Kakion disappeared for a little bit because he got blinded. Like, there's just some weird parts of it that maybe aren't as fun as everything else, but there's just so many good moments that encapsulate Stardust Crusaders and make it so iconic that if you're into JoJo, it should be one of your favorite parts. You know, I'm not saying it has to be your favorite, it's not mine, but it should be one of the ones you definitely like a whole lot. But even if you aren't into, or say you don't know enough about the JoJo franchise, this is definitely the part to start with, because this is where I think you can get the easiest and most digestible introduction into this universe while still getting the most out of it.
It's awesome. It's just a lot of fun to go through. It's really easy to get into because it's such a simple story, with simple but memorable characters. The only real thing that is kind of difficult to get into, yeah, I guess, is the stance. And I guess if you really don't like the mechanics of it, then, well, it's not the series for you. But it's... you get a little bit of everything in it. You know, you get weird, gross violence... that is mixed in with humor, sometimes, like, in the same instance, honestly. just using horrible, horrific violence for the sake of humor, which is kind of weird. And it's just got a lot of badass fights in it. A lot of fights, because it's all fighting.
All it is.
That's the other thing. If you're looking for something that is more than just fights, there are occasional bits here and there, like when they go up against Darby and it's a gambling match instead of them being able to punch him. And it's also the fact that it's not always a straightforward fight. They've got to, you know, figure out the trick behind defeating someone. But it's really ceaseless action. So if that's what you want out of a series, then yeah, definitely give it a try. And maybe it'll be your gateway into the rest of the series.
And I'm looking forward to then the next time we do one of these, because that's what we'll be
doing. Diamond is Unbreakable.
Diamond is Unbreakable. That's by far my favorite part of the JoJo's franchise.
Even though in this story there is a part where Jotaro breaks things that are supposedly as hard as diamonds. So
yeah, well, he does very briefly fight Crazy Diamond in Diamond is Unbreakable. So maybe we'll discuss that next time. So that'll be for next time we do one of those, but in the meantime, we have a shit ton of manga to talk about, including the end of a 7-part or a 7-year-long series. So
let's get going. Recap portion, weekly manga recap. Let's start with Black Clover, page 87. Not a failure. Asta last time declared he would use his special move on Fauna. He gets ready to do that. Doesn't get to. Of course. He'll get to do it later, I'm sure. Fauna's heat is so overwhelming that Asta is getting blown away just by the waves of hot air that the dragon is casting whenever it swoops down over the forest. Fineral can't even manipulate space. Vanessa's threads are being burned away. So all of our heroes, their magic isn't working at all, but just in the face of this overwhelming power. Except, of course, for Noelle, because she has water magic, which can directly defeat fire magic. But even her water is evaporating in front of the dragon because it's just so overwhelmingly hot. But Noelle is thinking to herself, like, I'm the only one who can actually defeat this. I've got water magic, so I've got the type advantage. I've got my Squirtle, and she's just got a Charmander. So I can do this. I can do it. I can do it. But she hears these voices in her head, the voices of her family looking down on her and mocking her, calling her a born loser and a failure, that she can't win. She can't, you know, even when she used her super special awesome magic in the Underwire, you let your anger take over, and it just happened to go. It's got lucky. But then she hears another voice saying, that's not true, you're strong. She looks down at her wand, she's like, this other voice. And then she hears Asta is like, you're strong, Noelle! I'm the only one who's allowed to inspire anything in anybody! Only I'm allowed to be the inspirational force in this series! Only me!
Me, the most important character in the show? Do you remember Wacky Deli episode of Rock Goose Martin? Oh, you didn't watch Nickelodeon as a kid?
Never watched it, no.
Oh, this Wacky Deli reference is completely wasted upon you. I'm gonna find a clip of it so I can show you.
Can I take your anal virginity, by the way?
She's like, no time, no. Maybe. Can't you wait till I'm drunker to ask this?
thinks to herself, oh yeah, that's right. If I lose heart, both he and Asta will get mad at me, so I gotta give it together. And then she's like, oh, shut up, Dorksta! She gets her wand ready and prepares to cast Sea Dragon's Roar and unleashes it towards Fauna while declaring, I'm not a failure anymore! The dragon flies up and Fauna manages to barely dodge out of the way of it while summoning a big, massive crystal.
One thing I'll note that I really liked about it, I loved Fauna's face in the panel where she summons the dragon, because that is, like, you can still see she's kind of, like, in her, like, crazy mode, but that is, like, just pure terror on her face, like,
Jesus!
Like, just pure horror, and I like that coming from a character who's fighting someone that's not just Asta. Like, it's cool that, like, Noelle has invoked that kind of terror in somebody.
So, everyone's like, oh shit, she dodged! And Noelle starts to doubt herself for a second again. I knew it, I can't. no, I'm not done. And she twitches her wand around, and the dragon turns around in midair, makes a U-turn, and bites into Fauna's mount, and it vanishes in the face of it. And then Noelle looks up at her wand, and she goes, Bruce, we did it. And I just go like, this better not be another thing from that goddamn novel.
It is interesting, because she says Bruce, and she also says, back when, oh, hold on, maybe she just meant, no, hold on. Yeah, she says, was I just hearing things? That's right. If I lose heart, both he and Asta will get mad at me. So I'm like, who's the he? Like, is her wand have a life of its own? Or, like, does she just call her wand Bruce and gave it a personality? Or is she referring to someone else? Cause
is she referring to Yami?
Maybe she's thinking about Nozel or Nozel, whatever his name is, her older brother. Because even though he's in the panels there, he doesn't look to be one of the ones antagonizing her. But, I mean, we know he's kind of still a shithead. Like, I'm just wondering who this person is, because I don't feel like it was introduced very much before this. So I can't tell if this is, like, a foreshadowing or, yeah, like, if this is another light novel thing that I just didn't catch up on.
I imagine it's probably foreshadowing.
That's my hope. I mean, that's essentially the end of the chapter.
Yeah. Asta's like, now I'll use my special move.
Yeah, and there's a moment where they couldn't find a good way to do it because they don't have the ability to, like, lay over words atop each other, but they're like, yeah. Now it's your turn!
It is kind of awkward there, yes.
Yeah, but, you know, I don't have an issue with this. I think it's cool. Like, I like Noelle getting her cool moments. It's almost though I wish this had been the kind of moment that happened at the end of the arc in the temple as opposed to here, because it didn't feel like there was much, like, build up to this, and it seems like a really cool moment. Like, Noelle gets to be a badass. She gets to have this moment where she summons an awesome attack, and one of the eyes of the Midnight Sun's like, oh shit, like, now I'm terrified. Now I'm the one who's, like, shitting my pants over this. And it's cool that she has that, but, like, going into this, I forgot Noelle was even there. Like, she just, like, I forgot she was even a part of this. So I wish it had been, like, this had happened earlier, there had been a little bit more build-up to this, but I'm glad she has it. I'm glad Noelle looks cool.
It feels a little bit too much like just an echo of the previous moment that she got, you know, one that's fainter because it's not as built up to or earned, and also it's just she unleashes the dragon again. I mean, she has better control of it this time, which is a step forward,
and
but
I guess
it feels weird because it's like it's used for this setup to something else as well. That kind of seems to come out of nowhere.
And you even just brought something up that I forgot about. She doesn't beat Fauna here. It looks like Asta's still going to come in with another attack, which is essentially what happened last time. Like,
exactly.
Yeah, it'd be nice if she could finish off somebody for once as opposed to, like, I'll weaken you, and now Asta, like my fucking Pokeball, is going to go out there and finish things off. But, hey, it's fine enough. I enjoy that the first time in this series, the other characters are reacting to how much Asta annoys them with his screaming, so that was well enjoyed. But yeah, I thought...
Stop yelling!
Like, God damn it! Fucking chill out! What's going on, kiddo?
Let's move on to Boruto. Number 7, Collision. So, things kind of accelerate really quickly in this chapter. Last time they set up to go and rescue Naruto. This time they go rescue Naruto.
Yeah.
They just catch up to where he's, you know, tied into this big tree, having his chakra drained. And, Momoshiki, the villain, is there, just, you know, taking his chakra and stuff. And then the other Kages come in and start attacking. And Boruto cuts his dad loose, and Sasuke catches him while the other Kage are engaging him. There's a little moment between Boruto and Naruto. Naruto apologizes. Naruto's like, no, it's okay. And, you know, whenever, you know, you get the chance, you can tell me about your past instead of lecturing me. And, you know, and they hold hands for a little bit. And then it's like, okay, we gotta get back to the fight. They managed to catch the bigger of the two guys, and then, they go after Momoshiki, and they explain to Naruto, as he's getting ready to use his Shadow Clone Jutsu, that no, you can't use ninjutsu against him, because that's what he does. He absorbs jutsu and then uses them to fuel his own attacks. But when the ammunition is gone, he's kind of helpless. So they just have to beat him without using ninjutsu, which is fine, because, like, everyone in this fight has some sort of a weapon or taijutsu technique that they're... So... there is a cool little moment where Gaara cooperates with Darui by launching out these two platforms of sand for him to vault across or for him to slash his sword at Momoshiki. That's a moment that I like.
Yeah.
But all that it comes down to, really, is that Momoshiki looks like he's defeated, and he starts to lecture them for a bit, you know, blah, 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 blah. You use the jutsu. This is how my clan does it, instead of your weak one. And then he just absorbs the other guy, turns him to a... goes... It's like the least dignified way to eat this fruit. Just...
I will say, actually...
That gives him fuel, so...
I like the action in this chapter a lot, actually. There's a lot of actually, like, well-choreographed fights between the various members. A lot of them, I'm like, who is this? What's this person do? Who is this again? But even then, I'm still like, yeah, it's like, cool action going about here.
Chojuro, Kuratsuchi, Darui, Gaara.
Good job, Nick. This is why...
I don't remember the big guy's name, though.
This is why you make that big podcaster money. Yeah, like the Chris Collinsworth of the manga podcasting scene. And I'm the Jay Gruden.
Okay.
John Gruden? Which one's the one that's a host and not a football coach?
John Gruden.
There you go. I'm the John Gruden. See, once I get my own name right, then I'll be the John Gruden of the manga podcasting world.
No, you just gotta love quarterbacks, and that's it. Let me tell you something, I love this guy.
This guy's measurables are off the charts. Yeah, but he's thrown 4 interceptions. Who cares?
That was a great play. He threw the ball away. That's a positive play in my book.
Didn't hold it too long.
I'm a coach, I just don't want you to make a mistake. So, throwing the ball away, that's not a mistake, it's a positive play in my book.
Sir, he wasn't out of the pocket. That's intentional grounding at 15 yards. It was better to have just taken the sack. Positive play. All of our audience are just
excuse
like,
me, did you coach a team to the Super Bowl? No, I don't think so.
They're like, some would say you didn't either, considering you just inherited
Tony. You just kind of took over from the foundation that Tony Dungy laid for you. It was basically gift wrapped for you. Yeah, but they needed an offensive coach. Your team was ranked like 21st in offense that year. It was really just the defense that Dungy built.
Wasn't Mike Glenn your quarterback in the Super Bowl?
Excuse me, sir. That was Brad Johnson.
Oh, that's right.
I have a Brad Johnson fucking jersey in my closet, I'll have you know.
That's some pride right there. I could hear it in your voice. We should probably move on because I feel like everybody in our audience is like, what are you talking about?
Honestly, if you compare like the way the team did under him versus how they did under, while he was injured, he actually did make a really big difference for the team, even if he wasn't very good. Anyway, yeah, That's the chapter. Momoshiki absorbs the other guy, and now he's got all these black marks on him, and he's got a third eye opened up, and he goes, "You're next!" And then he beats Brock Lesnar in 87 seconds, and everyone's like, "What the fuck?"
And I'm sitting there just like, guys, come on. Did we not remember the last time these guys fought and it sucked ass?
It's better than the alternative. Trust me. Oh, God. You want them to just stare at each other and shit all over the crowd for 10 minutes? They could do that. Okay. So, that's Barto. An alright chapter, some nice action. I guess then we are going to move on to Demon's Plan.
Yes, I will fully admit, Nick, I did not have the chance to read this one too fully. Both times I tried to re-jump this week, I was a little pressed for time and had to skip over this, so...
Yeah, honestly, I really just kind of... It didn't really sink in on me. The gist of it is that in this world, there is something called the Demon's Plan, where if you spend a whole bunch of money, you get entered into this kind of lottery system, and there's a chance that because they hold out this, like, box to you. And if there's a possibility that a demon's hand will reach out through the box and grab your own and grant you some sort of a wish. So our two main characters are these two street kids who do work really hard, scrounge up and save in order to get all this money. One day they, you know, finally hit like the $1 million necessary to get this contract and have a chance at having their wish granted. But a corrupt police officer overhears them talking about it in the bar, so he goes and is like, I think that you guys robbed that rich guy, and that's where you got that money from. So they just kind of make an arrest, and they're planning to kill Carlos, the supporting character. And then the guy who conducts this ceremony approaches him and is like, oh, maybe you'll have a chance to try this devil's contract here. Why not? And he's like, ha ha, fooled you. It's all just a parlor trick. It's not real. None of it's real. You idiots just pay us all this money to have absolutely no chance of anything happening. But then the real demon's appears before him and he gets demon powers and he kills them all. And then he goes and he confronts his friend, who's the main character, and he makes the demon's contract and they fight each other for a bit. And then Carlos gets dragged off by the demon. And it's very confusing, honestly. It started off being very different than it ended up becoming, and I don't know, it's something about it all just doesn't really click with me.
I think I'm still sitting here just quietly like, come on, Amalgam of Distortion, picked up, going to run in Weekly Shonen Jump America, come on, make it happen.
Come on, Amalgam of Distortion.
I know it's been a month since that stopped being a jump start, but I'm hoping for that surprise add-on. Toriko's gone, you gotta put something back in the magazine. But yeah, we should move on then, I think, to Fairy Tail. Yeah. Chapter 511, The Hell of Hunger. So, last time, Licarde and Sting had a fight. Sting. And Sting showed up and was like, I eat white magic and light magic, so I am your counter. And that's where this one picks up, with Sting having to say, like, it's weird, you smell like Natsu, but, like, even if you were family, you'd smell similar, but not the same. Like, you smell just like Natsu. I guess further adding sort of a credence to the idea that maybe Natsu is a clone as opposed to outright still a person. So maybe this guy is a clone of Natsu, essentially. But the fight continues. Licarde tries more of his attacks, but Sting just eats them. He devours them. At which point, he uses a different magic, and he uses that, what was it, pleasure magic, I think he called it, or, I can't remember exactly, was it pleasure magic or something else? Essentially, the same thing he used to make everyone really horny, he's now using to make Sting really, really hungry, and because he feels hungry, I guess his strength has been sapped, because Dragon Slayers need to eat to gain power. So Sting, in his, like, delirious state, looks over to Lecter, who's calling out to him, and envisions him as an enormous, like, fucking drumstick of meat, and then starts trying to eat him. And then we like, look over, and fucking Yukino has started, like, nibbling on fucking Kaguya's shoulder, trying to eat
it's
her,
It's really, really, really weird, because it begins as kind of sexual, and then it turns into them just, like, taking big bites out of each other and drawing blood. And it's like, is this supposed to still be sexy? I don't know when it comes to you, Hiro.
Well, it first starts off comedic, because he envisions his fucking cat partner as an enormous chicken drumstick, and he's trying to eat him. Like, that's something out of a fucking, like, Looney Tunes cartoon. Then Yukino shows up, and she nibbles, like, just bites onto fucking Kaguya's shoulder, and that's when it feels like it's almost like a kink. But then, as you said, yeah, they just start, like, taking bites out of each other, but they have, like, these giant, goofy, like, fucking spiral eyes that makes it feel like it's, like, a weird comedy again. And Licarde even explains this now. Like, he has a whole, like, fucking speech about, like, sex, hunger, and sleep. Or sex, food, and sleep. It's the three things all of us need. And that basically serves to confirm your theory, Nick, that I guess that was some weird indication that maybe Mavis wasn't completely chaste or something. I don't know, but it's pretty explicit there as opposed to just being ambiguous pleasure magic. Sting essentially snaps out of his, I don't know, hypnosis, whatever you want to call it, and is like...
He's broken out of figure four!
Yeah, and he's like, oh, I'm the master of Sabretooth! And I do like the Carnage who's like, boom, never heard of it. Just fucking impales him with his stupid cross thing. And he's like, you're not even in Fairy Tail? What the fuck's the point of you then? And Sting like pulls the cross out of him and he's like, you know, we may not be Fairy Tail, but Fairy Tail made us who we are and I'm gonna do this for Natsu. So Rogue shows up and basically throws all of his shadow magic into Sting saying, eat this, eat my magic and get stronger. So Sting does that. He starts eating shadows, which I guess he can do because shadow and lights are opposite. I don't know how he eats it because they've only been able to.
Well, you know, it's like when Natsu ate lightning magic.
That is true. Actually, you're right. He did do that before. So I guess that has something they established before. I was trying to remember if he ate steel too at one point, but I thought he couldn't. But I might be remembering really far back in the series or something that doesn't even happen. So Sting eats his magic and gains his power and becomes the White Shadow Dragon Slayer. And he says, I'm all fired up. Which wasn't a cool catchphrase to begin with, and now that other characters are appropriated, it feels significantly lamer. But yeah, that's the chapter. He used hunger magic on everybody, and then Rogue fed him his power, so Sting is a Shadow Light Dragon Slayer, and presumably will fight and win. I don't know. The only thing that was really worth noting in this chapter for me is I love the card I just shitting all over Sabretooth, where he's just like, what, you're not Fairy Tail? What's the fucking point? Stab.
I don't know. I'm really not into this fight, so.
It's tough. It also doesn't help that Sting looks a lot like Natsu, like, in these moments. It's hard to, like, differentiate them to it, so much so that it's almost to the point I'm like, why not just use Natsu? Like, I feel like Sting just doesn't have enough of a personality on his own.
Anyway. All right.
Food Wars. So, yeah. Guys, last week was a little bit misleading with the whole...
Here we go. Yeah, that was it. Gajeel absorbed Rogue's map.
That's right. He became a Shadow Metal Dragon Slayer, too. That's right. Point. Okay.
Where were we now?
Food Wars.
Food Wars, Shokugeki no Soma. So last time, Soma had bested Hayama, only for us to learn that several members of the Resistance had been defeated. So we were throwing around some ideas about who all had been defeated. It turns out, almost everybody.
Yeah, it was like last week, it's like, oh, wow, the bikini girl, Aldini's brother, and the secretary girl all got, I can't remember any of their names at this point, all of them got cut out.
Ikumi, Hisako, and...
you're like, shit, fat Aldini brother, fuck, whatever. But, like, you're like, oh, wow, like, all those characters have been cut. Like, that's a big deal. I wonder how they're going to go forward, like, try to get them back or whatever. And then it's like, oh, by the way, Kurikiba, Alice, and every fucking other person except for Todoroki and Aldini have been cut as well. You're like, oh, why didn't you end last week with them getting fucking cut instead?
The only thing that I can think of is that they were trying to just show the people who, like, the most to our main cast.
Yeah.
It's, you know, Gumi, and Alice. Well, Alice would have made more sense, I think, than Gumi. It's chapter 192, Wild. Erina catches up with Soma, and Soma's like, hey, you doing okay, Erina? You look kind of stressed out. She's like, I wasn't worrying. I wasn't worrying at all. It's not like I like you or anything.
Dorksta.
Shut up, Dorksta.
We mind about it on that, Nick.
But, Sean Aida, Azami Nakiri's aide, enters and says, anyway, so, Akira Hayama, you're expelled. And they're like, what? Well, yeah, that was the deal that I made with Azami, which is that, you know, if I failed to actually do what he instructed, then... yeah, I'd be expelled. You know, this was all for the sake of trying to keep the Shiomi Seminar open, so, you know, I deserve this. Oh, and also, by the way, I've got some of the results of the other exams. Yeah, Hisako lost, and Ikumi lost, and Misami lost, Kurikiba, Alice, Yoshido, and what's her name? Fucking long-haired girl. All of them lost! And all the girls get to have their clothes torn up, but not the guys.
Out of curiosity, was that something that's happened before when people have been defeated? Like, do they have their clothes torn off before?
It's usually just been...
it's when you eat the food when it happens, right?
I mean, clothing damage has been a thing in fan service-y series, so what? But it is, I guess, a bit different than what we've seen thus far.
Something to note, Nick. I'm looking through to try to remember, and they don't show it. So there's a chance the Polaris Bro Goods may not have been expelled. They may have beaten their person.
No, they say that literally everyone except for Megumi and Aldi.
Someone may have accidentally just drawn an X on those pictures for unrelated reasons.
Ibusaki has been defeated. Fucking scrawny, sick as hell glasses guy has been defeated. Very thorough. And then Rindo comes in and she's like, hey, do you think you've got time to worry about those guys? You do remember that Aldini and Tadakura went up against me, right? And then Rindo rushes off and she's like, no, it can't be. And Aldini and Megumi are just kind of there, just going, yeah, what's going on? He was like, did you pass? Well, you see.
Flashback to her like, now it's time to taste. Let's have a bite of your dish, Aldini. Dramatic music. Chomp. Yum! You pass. Like,
all right, Tanaka, let me try yours. Yeah, it's delicious too. Okay, you guys are both okay. We just cut back to the presses, and Rindo is saying, it's like, I got free reign to run the stage 3 exam for those two. So I decided that to pass, they needed to make a dish I thought was good. And they did. They passed. Bam! Done. Yeah, the orders were to have them go head-to-head against a council member, but nobody said it had to be a competition. And so Sean's just there, like whatever.
Fine. Now, to note, because I'm reading people in the chat who are saying they didn't like this chapter, just to note, this is something that's been firmly established to be part of Ringo's personality for a while. She loves food, and she's easily, despite the fact she's the second seat on the council, she's easily the most lenient member, or the one who has the least amount of, like, fervent loyalty to Azami's plan. She's the one who's shown the most, like, opposition to it, or reluctance, or not reluctance, but remorse for some of the things that it's caused. So, of anybody, her being the one to kind of be like, oh, I kind of gave them an easy pass out because they impressed me with food. It feels very right with her character.
And also, I mean, this is something that we were calling for this. So, I mean, it's interesting because what we get from this is, you know, everyone is thinking to themselves, shit, what are we supposed to do? All of our friends have been defeated all of a sudden. And so we just very quickly thinks of, okay, hang on, I got it. Okay, there's four of us here, so, well, okay, well, what if we just, you know, form a majority on the council of 10, go take it by defeating some of the other council, then we'll just, you know, end up on the council of 10, and then we could effect change to get all of our friends back. You know, it's a very straightforward approach to things, but it's weird that we're suddenly cut down from all these different chefs to just these four. Three of them are definitely, you know, the most important characters in the series up to this point, because you've got Soma, you've got Arina, and then you've got the real female lead, Megumi. But it's really weird that they've cut out Alice for this, and Hisako and Kurikiba, these guys that looked like they were going to be big parts of the resistance. So, I mean, obviously, this isn't, like, just going to be the end game of this whole arc central with Azami, them being the last members of the resistance. That just feels wrong to me, that's how this is going to end up playing out, is that, oh yeah, we got our friends back, and that's the end of that. I feel like there's going to be something more. At the same time, though, I'm glad that we actually do the members of the repeated because, God, there were a lot of characters in there.
There were
a lot of expendable characters, to be frank.
Like, yeah, it's very surprising to me that, like, Alice, I think more than anybody, is one who gets cut, because I felt like she had a big role potentially in this. But the thing is that this isn't the end of anything. And I actually really like this direction. One, this was surprising. Like, I like this twist thrown in there that they didn't horseshit their way out of this. It wasn't like the Tsukasa bet. Even that, I think, had its fair thing. But it wasn't like they were like, it's a tie. Nobody gets eliminated. They're like, no. Everyone had to go against a Council of Ten member. And because they are that good, all of your resistance failed to beat them. Except for, essentially, you know, Soma overcame a weakened Hayama. And Rindo let her two people pass because she's a fucking flighty food bitch. So I like that they've actually shortened it to four people. And I just said three of them are the core members of Shokugeki no Soma. And Aldini, despite the fact he's not as fun as I think those other characters, he has been presented as being one of the big rivals for Soma. He's just been kind of buried beneath the fact that in recent memory, Kurokiba and Hayama both performed better than he did, and Alice has had more screen time, so all those characters feel like they're above them. But Aldini was kind of, like, initially put in as almost, like, the lancer in a way, like, the rival character to Soma. Like, he was his first big opponent, and they have that kind of relationship. So I'm not actually opposed to him being in there. And plus, the Italian stereotype with his food style is something you have a lot of versatility with. So I like that they've cut it down to these four, and I like that they have a goal. Like, I love that they're, like, we'll just get a majority on the council, and we'll bring our friends back that way. Like, it makes sense. It's still weird to me, because I'm like, but you don't have a majority, because you're actually still the minority with you four? Like, I know Hayama's gone, but that's
even
nine.
Even if Rindo decides, this is boring now, I'm going to side with them, that's still only 5 out of 10.
It's like, I guess if they don't fill that one seat, and Rindo switches for you guys, then you have it. But otherwise, you're still the minority. But still, I like that premise of, we're going to take the fight back to, like, pushed against the wall like this, we're going to take the fight to them and try to take their seats. That way we can get onto the council and initiate change. And it's cool because this is a chance for us to see the Council of Ten in a more, like, face-to-face kind of manner. You know, we had to tease to the fact that new members were brought in to fill the seats left behind by the people kicked out. We still know Aizen is still on the council on there somewhere. We've slowly been gaining little bits more of some of the lower members of the council, and I'm really interested to see this idea of, like, Megumi having to go up against a Council of Ten members seriously with the ambition and goal of, like, I have to take your seat to save my friends. Like, this is exciting stuff that happens here, and, you know, who knows what'll come of this? I'm just imagining
Ku coming along and is like, so, you gotta take on the council now and try to get those seats, huh? So why didn't you bet on Hayama's council seat again? Well, I didn't know I needed.
Yeah, what are you just fucking? But, like, I'm excited for this. Like, this feels like there's direction in the series, and it feels like we have, like, an exciting thing to look forward to going forward. Like, we have three huge fights on the horizon. We don't know who they're against yet, but we know all three of these people here that aren't Erina, who's already on the council, now are like, we have to make the Council of Ten so we can get our friends back. And yes, maybe they do take some of the seats, maybe they don't. Whatever happens, you just know that it's their way of getting people back on the council. And look, there's still nothing saying that the people who have been eliminated aren't still, one, going to be a part of the story, but two, can't still be involved because, look, there's the ambiguity of rules. You could get it so Alice challenges a person on the Council of Ten saying, I'll do this, and if I win, I get back into school in this council seat. If I don't, I'm fucking never getting to come back to the school or whatever. Like, there's still that room to play with here, you know? Like, there's still some flexibility there. So I think there's still potential for surprising things, but I just like that things feel focused and are building up to marquee matchups. Like, that's what I'm really interested in.
Moving on to My Hero Academia, meeting in Tartarus. All Might went to confront All For One in the super high security prison facility that he's being contained in. It's a very, like, conversation with Hannibal Lecter situation. You know, they're separated on the two sides of this prison, but you feel that even though All for One is the one trapped inside, he's the one who's got power in this situation. Because he knows so much about what's going through All Might's head and what's going on. And All Might's trying to find out more. He's trying to find out what Shigaraki's location is. And it's like, I don't know. I've let him go off on his own now. My student is further along. He's trying to find out what he's doing and what his goals are and how he's been accomplishing stuff. And he's just like, I can tell you, but I mean, you never actually accept it. And I'm just not going to bother trying to explain myself to you. You know, I've held onto my ideals and acquired the power to embody them. And I have spared over to live forever in a world shaped by those ideals. And he even laughs when All Might asks him a question because he understand what he's doing this all for. But All Might's kind of getting ready to leave, and so everyone's like, no, don't go yet. I have more I want to say to you. And he starts talking about how All Might's retirement changed the world. He's just accurately predicting all this stuff that's happening, the panic that people are feeling, the reactions that people, the reluctance that people have to accept that Endeavor is going to be the new pro. And so people are telling him, you know, All Might knows, and he's being told he has no idea what's going on. So don't tell him anything. Don't confirm any of his suspicions. Don't let slip any information that you have. Who knows how he'll use that. But is just mocking him because of All Might's weakness. The fact that everyone now knows that he's this what his real is. He's got all the power in the situation. It's cool that we have a villain is in this completely helpless situation, but he's still got one over on the number one hero, basically. Mm-hmm. And All Might gets pissed off by the end of it because he knows that All For One's plan is to have Shigaraki kill him and also kill Deku. So he tells him, I won't die and I won't let Shigaraki, won't let myself be killed. The future in store for this world isn't the one that you want. And the future you foresee, I'll smash it as many times as it takes and you'll be the one watching in horror while you live out your remaining years. Just walks away and exits. As All For One kind of laughs to himself. He goes, for years, right. Which seems to imply he knows he's going to die soon.
Very likely.
It's an interesting setup that we've got with One. Because we were introduced to him where it seemed like he was in his... It seems as though whenever he eventually dies... series that presence is still going to be felt through it. And that's an interesting thing to have that unseen presence. And then we get caught up with the present because we've got Deku having sent the text with the image of his provisional license off to All Might. And then we go over to Deku's group as they're reacting to everything. Chilling at the dorm and their casual clothing. And, they're just messaging different people. And, Bakugo then grabs Deku's attention, says, hey, meet me out front later. We gotta talk about your.
I wasn't crazy into this chapter. If only because, like, the whole, like, villain speaking to the hero on the opposite side of a prison cell and the villain knows too much, it's a trope kind of as old as I feel like these stories have been told, and it's not like this is a bad scene or anything like that, or I'm saying, like, it's too stereotypical. It doesn't strike out at me because, you know, I've seen this sort of thing done before. But the ending, just with, you know, Deku on this high note after just saying something positive to his mentor, and Bakugo walks by and just says, just the foreshadowing statement of, we gotta talk about your quirk. And this is something we've kind of been anticipating for a while, as it seems that Bakugo, who we know is not a dumb kid, has picked up on the idea that Deku's quirk in some way relates to All Might's. So it's an exciting thing, if only because I'm like, I want to see next week now. Like, that's more than anything. I'm like, I want to see this confrontation or what comes of it. Because Bakugo's face doesn't even look angry there. So
no, he's just kind of serious.
Yeah, we might see a different side of Bakugo than we usually see. Maybe because this is going to involve the one thing he has that's really important to him.
Let's head on to One Piece, chapter 846, Tamago Security. Last time...
Also known as Oda Fixes His Problem with Drawing Women, also known as Baron Tamago Has Way Too Much to Say.
last time, Luffy and Nami were being attacked by Big Mom's forces as revenge for him defeating Cracker. And Luffy, of course, isn't moving, so they're not running away. Nami is in a fight with someone. I don't know who.
I don't know if they ever reveal her name, and I don't know if they ever reveal... Like, obviously she's immobilized her in some way, because I can't understand a reason why Nami would just be kneeling there with her hands above her head otherwise, but I don't see, like, any kind of restraint or anything, so I guess she has some kind of power to hold people, or some kind of invisible bonds or something.
The big tree is attacked by a woman in a wide-brimmed hat named Lady Amande. And she has a sword that she refers to as the famed blade Shirao Ice Fish. And she cuts into the tree's head, and he's like, oh god, that's so painful, please just kill me.
Well, no, it needs to be fucking Cherrymon from Digimon, where he's like, oh, the horror!
No, no!
It's specifically, oh, the horror! The fact that they took one of Marlon Brando's most famous lines from cinema and used it of his being like, oh, I've lamented being killed by my evil puppet master!
Oh, God.
Fucking love Digimon.
But she denies him a swift death by saying, there is no point to slaughtering in a single instantaneous swing. I only cut my victims at the most excruciating speed possible.
So, we know who Brook's gonna fight.
there's some weird-looking opponents that there are. Like, there's a guy who is balanced on these flying books. Then there's the Minister of Cream, who's just fine, all sweet cream. And, Luffy starts to get his ass kicked because, the guy using the books has pulled him into the world of books where, you know, he's surrounded by these illusions. And then these two big thugs just smash him from either side with armament hockey, just crushing between their two huge fists. And it looks as though our heroes are basically down for the count. Nami gets Big Mom's Viva cards taken from her, and they see the fact that it says Lola on it. So they're like, did you kill Lola and take this? And she says, no, she's my friend, and she gave it to me. Luffy is still refusing to move from the spot, even as he's practically unconscious. He's gripping into the grass so that he can't be moved. The fight just kind of like, fine, steps on him. and then we cut to Whole Cake Chateau, where Big Mom just goes, okay. And so I'm just like, really? Yes! If you play by my rules, then we'll understand each other, and our current companions in the Straw Hat crew leave this island alive. Deal! Alright, great!
Thanks, sweet!
There's a really kind of awkward conversation between them because Sanji is completely relieved. And he says, yes, all right, yeah, fine. I promise I'll make Pudding happy. And of course, Big Mom's like, oh, you've fallen in love with my daughter, I see. But let me be clear. What the Straw Hats have done to me are things that I would never allow ordinarily. Destroying my seducing woods, eliminating one of my generals, not to mention eating all my sweets at Fishman Island and picking a fight with me. But your winning is the top priority at the moment.
Maybe she's so happy, Nick, because she knows that Pudding, who is evil, is planning something to basically break this rule so she can kill the Straw Hats. Just saying, it's out there.
But for the moment, things seem to be going well between Sanji and the Charlotte family. I like how Big Mom's, because we know that the Jolly Roger on her head, you know, is alive because of her powers, and so its expressions are changing along with her as she's going through this conversation. So, you know, she's happy and it's laughing, and then she gets all messy, so it goes, and then she's laughing again, and it's like, We then cut to the treasure repository, where we get this long monologue from Tamago about the poneglyphs, including the poneglyphs that Big Mom's crew has under their possession.
Scattered throughout Lay World, there is text on stone tablets that have survived unbroken for hundreds of years. It is said there are roughly 30 of Lay poneglyphs in existence. Of them, 9 contain informations essentiales. By assembling and following them to the final island, Rafatel, the stones will begin to speak the truth of the world.
Dot, dot, dot.
Ik, please, generous smoothie, now! Have mercy on me!
Have mercy on me!
But in order to actually reach the island of Rafatel, we recreated the 4 Red Road Poneglyphs, including the stone that Jayambe recently brought us.
Now, generous smoothie, now!
Oh, that's kind of gross. She's literally just fucking wringing out
just
a chicken drink.
Wring her body, yeah.
The Big Mom Pirates are currently in possession of Tros poneglyphs in total. Doek's ordinary poneglyphs and Un Road poneglyph.
We're then introduced to General Smoothie, Charlotte Smoothie, the 14th daughter of Charlotte, one of the Sweet Three, the Minister of Juice, who, yeah, wrings out the juice of people's bodies in order to pour them into a wine glass which she drinks from. So she drinks people. She's this massive woman with weird boots and bizarrely long legs. And a really big helmet. And a giant sword on her back, too.
And a pretty fucking
like
big bounty.
Drill. It's a lance, I guess. A drill lance. And she has a bounty of 932 million. Well, shit.
Yeah, bounties have been steadily or substantially increasing in recent, like the recent year or so. So this fits in with that. And yes, as people are noting here, I will note that she. And the other ladies in this chapter also had it, but she does not look like Nami. She has features that make her distinctly different than the Nami-like characters.
Tamago notes that they know that Pedro...
We are most grateful for the help! Sorry.
Oh, God. Notes that Pedro's... history with the Big Mom Pirates was that he actually tried to steal one of the poneglyphs from them before, and has returned now. And of course, that they returned their attention to that and the fact that Anyway, he says that it's really important because it is our path to the King of the Pirates. They are so important that the 4 Emperors fight over their possession. We must risk our lives to protect Mama's Please. Most valuable clue.
He's not an idiot, Nick. We must risk our lives. With square. It's what you pour into milk to make chocolate milk. That's Nesquik. Whatever.
Brooke has sent his spirit in order to spy on this, so he overhears the whole conversation and then reports back to Pedro. So Major's like, well, shit, this is pretty bad that he knows that I'm here. I was hoping that we could, you know, actually do this without being noticed while Luffy's group was being waylaid. So, yeah. They're trying to figure out what to do. Brooke says, the harder we try to get here, the higher the chance of an all-out battle. It will be impossible for everyone to reach this location together. This might be our one and only opportunity. Paige says, but if we both go in there, then we're just going to die. So Brooke's like, what does Baron Tamago want? Maybe he's like, well, he wants me. Would you like to be a decoy then?
He also likes burgers and chicks with big tits and fast cars. Like, oh, okay. It's weird with the top hat and everything else he has.
I love this visual of Brooke and Pedro hanging out this wall together while Pedro smokes and Brooke's got the sunglasses on. The only two straw hats and allies that things appear to be going remotely well for at the moment. Hatching a plan together.
I like this chapter a lot. I like that we got some really interesting stuff out of it. You know, it was one of those chapters that cuts around a lot, but hey, you know, Luffy lost. We got some teases to various members of Big Mom's crew and kind of saw mm-hmm. some of their personality and some interesting powers. There's a book-based Double Fruit out there, you know, whatever, like another character who has like weird kind of song-based swordsmanship skills. It's interesting. I like everyone that they kind of introduced, and it's slowly building this arc into more and more of a distinct thing.
Set on to The Promised Neverland, Chapter 16, The Secret Room and William Minerva. Last time, Gilda and Emma revealed.
Just real quick, I want to just take a real quick note to say that the cover page this week is awesome. It's really cool in color looking. And there's a lot to be seen in it. Like, if you actually look at the reflections of Norman and Ray, you can actually see they have, like, very different faces and expressions than you think you would. Like, you see Norman with almost, like, a glaring sideways look, and Norman, or Ray has, like, a kind of a glare to him with his reflection. It's a very, very interesting cover page. I mean, they're always that interesting, but in color and everything like that, it really is distinct.
Yeah, if you look at it, you can actually tell that it is looking in Emma's direction for some reason.
That seems to be his MO, though. He seems to particularly care about her more than anybody else.
You can also see reflections in the glass behind them, which it looks like the facility. Mm-hmm. Anyway, last time Emma and Gilda revealed that they had learned the secret room in the house. It's located right next to Mom's bedroom, and she disappears into it at 8 o'clock each night. So Ranger says, yeah, it's probably for check-ins with their headquarters. She does it every day, and that's probably what it's there for. And Don's like, what are you talking about? Oh, you know, the base that supplies babies and sisters to this house. Oh, okay. Ray says that he didn't know that the room was there. He figured that there was one somewhere in the facility. And so Don is like, oh, there might be a clue where Connie and the others are. And they're thinking to themselves, oh, well, maybe we can go inside and investigate. And Ray says, well, there's no advantage to actually going in there, because the communication device is most likely only connected to the headquarters. Mom doesn't know where our siblings were sent. There won't be any records or clues. And if we go snooping around in there, then they might see they're on their tracking device, and that could give away the fact that we're snooping around. So the risks outweigh the potential benefits. So I don't think we should actually do this. We should just proceed with our current plan, break the devices, and get out of here. So Yoda looks disappointed, and Don looks really stressed out, but Emma and Norman immediately agree, and they decide to maintain their focus instead of ruining things by overextending themselves. Don and Gilda walk off on their own, and of course the remaining three carry on with how they're going to actually approach things in terms of, like, the demon world, as opposed to just, oh yeah, they're only being sold as slaves. So their next step is to focus on what they're going to do when they actually get outside, because they still don't really know what the world is. They don't know what kind of environment is outside. Emma thinks that she saw a forest outside of the wall, but they don't know for sure. They could be on an island, they could be in a desert. They don't really know what it's going to be like. So what they're going to do is they're actually going to climb the wall and take a huge look outside so that they can actually prepare themselves for what they're going to do. She also takes the two of them to the library because she's discovered something else. And Ray's like, oh, you're talking about the owl. And I was like, yeah, you noticed it too. William Minerva, who is this guy who is potentially someone who is actually an ally of theirs. He has been hiding a message in the books amongst many of them. He could be the key to them surviving outside the wall. And they might have a way to survive in the world if they mission. So things are starting to look up as they're researching, and Emma is, and Norman is like thinking to himself, like, oh yeah, no matter how the world is outside, we're fine. Dawn and Gilda are doing well. We've got 8 days until we execute the plan. As long as everything goes smoothly, be okay. Then we cut over to Dawn Gilda, who have decided to do something stupid.
I'm like, God damn it. You fucking nudniks.
Dawn bumps Mom in the hallway while he's running by, and uses that as a chance to snag her key, the key that can open every door in the house. And so he gets over with Gilda. It's like, I don't agree with the others. We should try and find out the truth. So let's go into Mom's secret room.
I fully expect this to be the guy who's going to be like, Mom's so dumb, I got her key right off her. That big dummy dumb dumb dumb, while his finger's on like the intercom button. Like, she's a big stupid person. I stole this key right off her, and I'm going to figure out all of her grand conspiracies, and she's never going to catch me. Oh, wait, is this
she's
thing
right
off?
She's right behind me, isn't she?
It's like, God damn it, you fucking idiot. It's an interesting chapter. The Minerva thing's kind of out of nowhere, but it's an interesting thing. Again, we've never seen an adult male character in this world yet, and there is this idea of, like, could anyone prior to this have been trying to escape and left clues? Or is this just another conspiracy of Mom? Like, in my mind, I almost find it hard to believe that clues would be hidden in these books or something like that, that these kids could pick up on that she wouldn't have in the past, you know, like,
right.
It just seems like kind of an interesting thing, but who knows? This is a new element, but it's a welcome one.
It seems like, I mean, this is a series that's kind of like, it's Emma was adding them. And whenever one thing gets resolved, it seems as though two more questions are raised. So I'm fine with the introduction of this and, oh, there's a mysterious books in the library, because it's a little weird right now, but I feel as though it's going to develop into something interesting down the line. So I'm willing to give it a chance. Mm-hmm. And meanwhile, you know, we've got this new complication of, oh, Dawn and Gilda are idiots, mostly Dawn. So he could blow their cover as a result of this reckless action. This might be the way that Dawn gets written out of the series.
I mean, things have been going well for them thus far, so they've kind of need some kind of setback, and this is a good way to do it, of showing...
Yeah.
Of very clearly, too, showing that Ray's kind of right about, like, adding more people only increases our odds of having our plans ruined, because this is someone that he wouldn't have suggested before. The only reason these two have even been brought into the fold is because we need other people to help us, like, control and wrangle in the kids. So... interesting thing.
We'll see how this plays out. Let's head on to Red Sprite, chapter 13, Ash Soldier. The Ash Soldier has been summoned after all of the different Plasmos were defeated from the enemy army. The Ash Soldier is introduced as the King of Thunder, Blackburn. Still love the way the guy looks with, like, this skeleton with flesh and clothing still forming around him. And his body is actually being formed by destroying the other Plasmero soldiers that his friends summoned from. That's pretty creepy. The rest of the chapter is one big long fight with Ashburn.
Oh.
Blackburn, sorry. Not Ashburn. That would be a little too ridiculous a name.
His
name is Fireburn.
I literally just looked it up, and apparently Red Sprite's ending next week. I was even reading this chapter, I was even thinking to myself, wow, it must be, maybe they're going to hold off on it for a little bit because of all the cancellations, because they haven't brought back, like, that awesome general evil villain character yet, so maybe they have at that time. It looks like next week we're going to get just, like, one of those, shit, I didn't think this is going to wrap up this quickly, I have to fucking sum everything up. Which is a shame, because Blackburn was awesome in this chapter.
We get a really complex, fast-moving fight between Blackburn and basically the entire crew of the Red Sprite. He, of course, sees that Mono is up on being their turret, so he zips up to the ship and throws him off of it, and Tatsu and Alfred have to work together in order to catch him out of midair. They float up into the sky on this platform that he's using with his magnetism. Tatsu jumps in and cuts his hand off, and Tatsu's engaging him from front using all the swords that they have at their disposal. And then, right at the end, when it looks like Tatsu has finally been defeated and is being pushed back, suddenly Alfred's huge-ass sword gets shoved in through the hole, smacks into Blackburn, and then Mono channels his super thunder through it directly into him. It's a big fight, but honestly, as I was going through it, I got this kind of sense of, I kind of feel like this, I know why the series is struggling, which is the fights themselves, characters don't really feel distinct from each other. Even though they've got very different abilities, the aesthetic that they have around them is too similar to each other.
Yeah, there's
it's too much people with lightning power.
Exactly. With a Shonen Jump kind of battle series, you kind of almost, and I hate to say this because honestly, I kind of like the fact that this manga's been able to kind of take a power of electricity based and just is finding different ways to use it. But it's almost like with Jump, you have to kind of give people different powers and things like that, that they can instantly be different and kind of distinct from one another. Honestly, I really, though, for this series, you know, it's ending, which is tragic. I can't, like, point out one thing, though, that I'm like, you know, this is the reason why this series didn't work. Because I feel like this series had a lot of things going for it. I think it had really awesome, like, you know, nothing in it was amazing of, like, the characters, but I thought they were all fine. And the art and the villains in this were some of the best we've seen in an early Jump series. Like, Blackburn is terrifying. The General Atlas, he was fucking great. Like, the series wasn't lacking for interesting elements. It just didn't work. Unfortunately, it didn't catch. And look, statistically speaking, that's going to happen more often than not, which is unfortunate. But, because I'm looking at the rankings now, and even Amalgam of Distortion, which you really like, that's ranking in the bottom five right now. So, and maybe that's not being added because that's not doing so great in Japan either. So, who knows?
So here, Yagi, I mean, the last series they did a lot like this one, in the case that I could look at it and I was like, I did like it. I liked the action and I liked the art, but I do understand if you say, like, oh, it's getting canceled, but yeah, I can see that it feels like something is missing. I can't point to any one part of it and say, like, oh, this was bad, this needed to be better, but it feels like something isn't quite there. It's that thing that, you know, the X factor, that thing that just kind of ensnares you, and makes you want more of it. It just doesn't have something. Don't know what it is.
What I will say is I'm really optimistic. I'm hoping that, Yagi keeps making series, because I feel like this is, an artist who would definitely get a series that finally sticks. Like, if he could just get the right premise. This is to be is someone who is very much like My Hero Academia and Horikoshi. Like, Horikoshi was a great talent. He did Barrage and that Zoom manga. Those were both interesting but ended very quickly. But you could see the talent there. And I definitely see the talent here with Yagi. Like, his art style, his ability to make, like, compelling villains and interesting fights and things like that. They're all there. He just needs the series that gets it all together and just hits right. And I think he will if he keeps trying at it.
Oh, and you know, Ashihara had a series that ran in Jump before. stuck mm-hmm. around for a little while, but it's, you know, not his first attempt. Nisekoi was not coming out with Shu's first attempt at several tries to get stick. You know, there was Double Arts and there was a few others. So, yeah, I agree. I think that Soma Hirayagi is definitely really talented, and I think that I'm going to eventually hit some. I look forward to when that happens, but mm-hmm. wish of this in.
Alright, I'm gonna run through Ruby here pretty quickly here. Ruby, chapter 4. Once again, there's no chapter names to these ones. So we're still dealing with Weiss and her backstory here. So last time we knew she was the youngest daughter of a very rich noble family, the Schnee family. And in this we find out she has an older sister, Winter Schnee, which is a funny name to me because I'm childish. And she has a little bit of a sister complex.
So it's like Snow White.
Well, yeah, White and Snow White. Yeah, it's a little on the nose. But she has a little bit of a sister complex because White is her, but even better. Like, she's effortless in everything she does. And, you know, even though her father dotes on White, he dotes even harder on White. And She's thinking about this as she's going through the fight, and she's actually kind of gets, like, fucking blasted in the face and starts bleeding out a little bit in the face. But she continues the battle, you know, using her power as defensively. It's still one of those, like, vague things that doesn't make a full sense in context quite yet. And the Observer is going on. He's like, you know, it might be surprising to you, but the President Dove does love you very much. He even mentioned that she enjoys your singing, but you know, he bears heavy obligations as the head of the family, and in addition to the responsibilities of employees, he also faces the increasing threat from the White Fang terrorist activities. You must understand, you know, it's that now that your older sister's away, we have high hopes for you, and Weiss just interrupts him and is like, if keeping me trapped was my father's way of showing affection, then I don't want it. And she kind of almost, like, impales the suit of armor with her rapier, bounces around and basically takes him off. As she's doing this, she's going through her monologue about how she used to think she was one of the chosen, and, you know, everyone only cared about her because she was part of the Schnee family, and she doesn't care about that anymore. She thought she wanted the praise, but it wasn't for her. She doesn't want that now. She's gonna be strong on her own. She doesn't need her family name. I must be proud of myself, like my sister Winter. And, then we cut away. I guess this was something, I don't know if this happened before or after, but it ends with her about to go on stage, presumably to sing. There, because she's talking to a charity event coordinator. He's like, I was surprised you came here to sing. And she's like, yeah, well, once I commit to something, you know, I give it my all. And that's the end of the chapter. This was a sort of a weird chapter, only in that I'm still not really sure I quite get Schnee's character, or Weiss's character, completely. I'm getting impressions of it. It's just, sort of, like, weirdly placed. Like, it almost feels like the battle was, like, distracting me from finding out who she was, because it's all, like, tied up within her flipping around and doing weird shit like that. So, it, you know, we'll see how it goes from here, but I'm still really not sure what this series is about. Let's finish this off, Nick.
Toriko, the final chapter. Everything is food. The end. We get a few things wrapped up in this chapter that weren't really touched upon in the last one, because that was just, you know, kind of a celebration. This one is much more a direct follow-up of, so, yeah, about that whole thing where all of the ingredients become plants and stuff like that. There are, like, food gods gathered around the plate that is the galaxy. But we get a few characters that, you know, have stuff wrapped up for them. Like, Komatsu meets up with, Taka? I forget his name.
Taki?
Yes. Taka Inuke. Yeah, that's it. So, Take has managed to fulfill his dream. He's made the big fairy tale castle. It's an orphanage, where kids can even eat God. And so he's achieved his dream by doing this. Oh, no, okay, he's a teacher. They're like, you're a prepared God, right? You're super good, right? Yes. Yes, I am. I'm super important.
You got me.
And Komatsu, meanwhile, is off to journey Toriko. And so Take's like, where are you going this time? We're going to outer space. Okay, then.
Fair enough.
And we get a callback to the very beginning of the series because Toriko is out fishing using this giant-ass bug for bait.
It's almost literally the scene from the start of the series. Like, the same right. bug, the same still chomping down a big cigar while he's doing it.
Uh-huh. And, so, Toriko says, I found out what the secret behind the gourmet eclipse was, Komatsu. What was it? Yeah, it's no big deal. See, apparently a giant gourmet satellite was just covering our view of the sun like a pot lid.
This is such, like, I went on for so long last week about how wonderful that chapter was, and it's so weird that the chapter that follows is so strange with, like, here are these thousand other things that could have happened. Like, part of me, not to interject here, but part of me thought, and I mentioned a couple times, I was like, you know, if they did any, like, arc after the whole thing with Acacia and Neo, I feel like the only thing they could have done was go to space, and there was still, like, potential there. And I almost feel like this chapter is like, yeah, I was planning to, but we just decided not to, or I just didn't want to anymore. Because he has everything there. He sets up an antagonist with the long-ago demon that apparently wants to gnaw on the sun and eat it. Like, they have this idea of, like, legendary gourmet fucking kitchen equipment that exists out there. Like, it's all there. And it's just like, yeah, well, that's how we're going to end the series. Coco who? Zeep what? No time.
Had a conversation with the food demons inside me, and they told me all this stuff about the gourmet gods and how, along with the expansion of the cosmos, pushed by the great number of ingredients that were scattered by the initial explosion, certain ingredients were smuggled out and protected by a certain god's family, and those later became the planet's full course meal. And then there was the gourmet Big Bang, and all that. All this backstory suddenly dropped in the last chapter, where it's never going to be used. As meanwhile, Toriko's got a giant fish, you know, a giant shell, and then they're like, okay, time to set off. Let's go. We're going to, you know, use this shell through selective breeding to turn into a spaceship, blah, blah. Where's Terry? Terry went back to his pack. The fight against Neo drove the active eight kings into retirement. Once a king has suffered a defeat, he is no longer considered a king at that point. Right now in the gourmet world, they're competing for who the next eight kings will be, and Terry's going to participate in the fight, too. Okay, I mean, yeah, that makes sense.
Yeah, we always kind of got the idea Terry was going to take over that role, too. Like, we knew that the Battle Wolf was one of the eight kings.
So, I'm cool with that. And then they just like, okay, we're gonna go off into space. Oh, and Coco and the others are already hunting off there.
I also like how he's like, and monsters from the other part of the world are gonna join in the fight, too. Like the Troll Kong, the Devil Python, and the Regal Mammoth. Which I like because, you know, those were like the earliest things Toriko fought, but he's just like, they've gotten remarkably stronger. I'm like, they multiplied their strength by like 10,000 times? Because that's what shit became by the end. Wasn't like the fucking like Troll Kong, like capture level 12 or some shit like that?
It was something like 10, yeah.
I mean,
Toriko defeated it by just like intimidating.
Yeah, I was like, that's sort of weird. But yeah, and then he's just like, oh, hey, Coco and Zeep are in space. We're going to go catch up with them. Like, what?
Where's Sunny?
And he has this whole long explanation, too, about like how the cosmos was split up into five colors, and those color demons have existed and were essentially like revived within Acacia's family and with Jiro and everybody like that.
And there's this place called the Ends of the Earth where unimaginable ingredients of the gods overflow endlessly and the people of the world thought that they'd like to eat them. So and then they're just off traveling through space and there are these weird things like, okay, so some of it, you know, is kind of to be expected. You know, there are giant creatures there. There's a turtle that has, you know, a shell made out of meteor. There's a massive snake that you can see a planet in its body that it has swallowed whole. There are freaking planets that are stacked up like Dongo.
I noticed
that. Then there's just a giant gun.
I just noticed that for the first time. Why is there a gun in space?
It's just a gun.
What is that? It's not even like a phone gun. It's just a gun.
And there's a freaking guy off somewhere who's like pinned to a moon for some reason.
It's like Shimabukuro went to copy scan the pages and someone had like a picture of a gun on it and he's like, ah, shit, that gun got on the page. Fuck it. Just send it.
Well, there's another one there too. There's one in the upper left corner.
There is. Why are there guns in space? Just giant, but specifically like current day man-made guns. What? Holy shit, this is boggling my mind. Holy fuck.
Anyway, that's Toriko, guys. Guns in space.
What a weird final. It's like, alright, calming myself down. This was a very strange final chapter. You know, again, just like with Bleach, I don't want to sit here and like, go over, like, the what I think happened, you know, behind the scenes. Maybe there was some kind of push to end the series faster, or maybe... Because I do feel like the details brought out in this chapter feel like Shimabukuro had plans to follow up with these, and this was a chance for him to kind of resolve them in one chapter, while still, like, putting out the promise, like, hey, the adventures continue, sort of thing. Like, what you always kind of want in a shonen ending. I don't think that the series was rushed. And certainly, if it was, it wasn't rushed in the same way Bleach was, because last week's chapter was like 38 pages. You know, Bleach didn't get that courtesy, and it still got to end after a fight in like its own peaceful kind of terms. It seems like Shirobuku kind of wanted to use this last chapter to get some things done. It's disappointing, if only because within the end of the series, we never really got any kind of cool closure moment between Toriko and the Four Kings. Like, they didn't get to interact in last week's chapter, and they didn't, like, they're not even here this week. They've literally gone to fucking space ahead of Toriko. So it's a shame, because those were, like, you know, the main characters to me. But that said, I don't look at this chapter, I'm like, what an awful fucking end of the series. Like, I still look at last week's, I'm like, last week was everything I wanted from an end to Toriko. This week was like almost like a weird what if that I could kind of ignore, except for the guns in space, which still boggles my mind. But, you know, it's hard to have any kind of negative feelings towards it when the series itself still got to end on, like, basically the best note it possibly could have.
Yeah.
That's my thoughts. So, hey, it was a fine series. Thank you to Toriko and to Shirobukuro-sensei for giving it to us. It was a joy to go through. I feel it's slightly a shame that we couldn't do more for Toriko. Like, this end kind of came out of nowhere and caught us at a point where we were already invested in doing JoJo and kind of caught us ending in the same week, so we couldn't give it a turn at the time. But it is tough to, like, almost gloss over the fact that this was a series that, you know, again, it's another series that we had when we started doing Weekly Manga Recap. Like, this was an original series we were discussing when we first did our original episode. And
remember when it seemed fresh and new.
Yeah. And, you know, it ran for almost a decade. Like, it may not feel like it ran as long because it didn't have the same kind of absurd chapter numbers and everything like that. But the series ran close to a decade, and that's nothing to scoff at. Like, this is a series that was very long-lasting, that had a ton of content to it. Like, at this point, yeah, Vine's bringing up in the chat, One Piece is the only series that we talked about when it originally came out and when we did our first episode that's still running in the magazine. Everything else has ended now. So, you know, it feels almost a little unceremonious in the way that we're kind of finishing off talking about Toriko, which maybe is most appropriate to the way the manga recaps treated Toriko when it almost became a joke to skip over in the recap, but I do want to give a sincere, like, kind of a farewell to Toriko. I think that it had a lot of ups and downs, particularly in these past few years, but Toriko at its highest was some of my favorite times reading shonen manga in the past decade. It was a ton of fun when it was doing everything right. It had a lot of really great fights to it, a lot of cool moments, and I definitely appreciate everything it gave. You know, I hope we see another series from Shirobukuro Sensei, and I still have nothing but fond memories for it overall as it leaves.
Yeah. I like it. It was really weird to leave on this note.
Mm-hmm.
Where it feels like it's the setup for the continuing adventures of Toriko in space! And for as much as did get extrapolated on and did get expanded and did get wrapped up, it's so weird that we just had, like, nothing for Coco and Sunny and Zebra to do for the last several years.
Yeah.
And it is disappointing in, you know, like, the Ice Shield 21 set. But overall, it's been a fun ride, I would say. I wish that more Coco had been like it was earlier on, but what we got out of it, I'm glad. It seemed to end on its own terms, and it was a really good chapter last, so I can tolerate how weird this one is because of how good it is.
Yeah. Overall, guys, it's just something I wanted to mention. The author's comments at the end of this, it's sort of sad because of all the comments, only one actually relates to the ending of Toriko besides Shirobukuro himself, which is Oda saying congratulations 8.5 years, you know. Considering when Bleach and Naruto ended, like, everyone commented on it, I do feel a little bit bad that only one person in this has commented on it. And again, you know, like, there was essentially like a 7-year-plus difference between the two, you know, running times. But still, I do want to stress, I am not taking anything away. We don't mean to undercut the importance of Toriko and Shirobukuro's sensei's work was. We didn't have enough time to plan a whole theme month around Toriko or enough foresight to give it its own episode and build up and all that stuff. But, you know, don't forget, this is a series that we enjoyed reading and we had fun with. You know, how many times have we made wacky jokes about the fact that Coco's entire identity is defined by poison or the fact that Toriko is so stupid he only thinks about food and, you know, was ignorant to everything else. How the world of Toriko just has one dude who's like, I don't like food, and just bitching endlessly about how these things work. Like,
channel is sent to this stupid tournament.
I want to watch soap operas, damn it! Like, we've had fun with this.
Honey, I'm sorry, man. I just learned that it's chocolate.
God damn it! All the plots are food related. You fucking tricked me again. My remote's a taco!
But, why don't you just cheat on each other?
No, that's how peanut butter cups were born. But yeah, no, guys, I sincerely love this series. I'm very appreciative for the fact that I'm going to be missing a weekly manga recap. It's going to be weird, too, because until World Trigger comes back, the current setup is to have the weekly manga recap end after talking about fucking Ruby, so we may have to shift some things around there, because that's a fucking weak noodle note to end the manga recap on, but
hurry back, Ashihara Sensei.
Yes, hurry back, and thank you once again, Shirobukuro Sensei, for everything that you did.
Mm-hmm. Had some good times because.
All right,
let's wrap things up by naming our favorites from this week, favorite series as well as weekly MVPs. Chris, why don't you start off?
Alright, my favorite series this week was a little tough to pick out. I came close to picking Food Wars, actually, because I really did like what they've kind of established with that. But ultimately, I went with One Piece, because I feel like One Piece did a lot of really good things in this. It introduced us to a whole new group of kind of villain characters, had some interesting stuff going on as it bounced around. It was just overall a really fun chapter, so I give it to One Piece this week.
I'm going to go with Food Wars myself because even though I'm a little bit shocked by the fact that we're losing some very important things, I like the direction that we're taking. It seems as though this conflict between Central and the Resistance is really starting to become more solidified in shape. And also the fact that, I mean, you could have just limited the losses to the more unimportant games. The fact that it was almost everybody. Someo was the only one out there group to get a legitimate victory. for one thing, it feels like the way that things honestly should have gone. You know, you went up against the 9 strongest students in this. Of course you're going to lose every single battle, because you're just a bunch of weak-ass first years. You're not going to win that fight 9 times out of 10.
And you can even argue Soma didn't win his fight cleanly, because it was a tie against an opponent who was overconfident and kind of lazy. So
yeah.
Even that isn't like a great, solid, like, kick-ass victory. He barely beat somebody who had lost his motivation.
Even if he had gone up against Azon again, you know, he might have lost the case. He pretty much went up against the one guy he had a chance of defeating, other Kobayashi, but, you know. So, yeah, we haven't really had a strong victory by our heroes yet. You have to put an asterisk on the one victory that they get, and it builds up Central better, and it actually adds stakes to this conflict that we actually have seen a bunch of important characters suddenly drop. And also the fact that it seems like we're going to get a bit more focused now with having fewer characters. So I think we're going to see some good things coming out of this.
Mm-hmm. All right.
MVP, this was really hard for me, because it feels like no character particularly shined. So I've actually gone with Dawn from Promised Neverland, because I felt like we needed a character to do something just stupid in this manga. And you know what? In a series where so far the dumbest character has been Crone, who is also a schemer, just having someone do something reckless and stupid to make things actually happen and break a bit of a standoff, I think is going to really help the series in the long haul. So.
Death Note would not have been as successful as it was if it didn't have Matsuda. You need that goober in the story that just helps shake things up by their stupidity, essentially.
And then just ends up shooting the fuck out of Light.
Yeah. So, yeah, that'll be the end of the series. Dawn shoots the fuck out of Ray. I had a lot of trouble picking one as well, so... This one's a bit strange, but I'm going to be going with Blackbird from Red Sprite. I just think I love his design of this dude whose, like, skin is constantly disintegrating to reveal, like, this almost, like, T-1000 exoskeleton underneath, but is repairing at the same time, too, which is a very cool, distinct visual look, and he was pretty intimidating. It's a shame the series is ending, but I think this guy was a really cool character, and that's why I think Yagi has such a potential going forward.
And running away with the favorite chapter among all was One Piece, with over 40% of the guys for voting, and be sure to do so next week as well.
Yes.
Okay. So, let's get ready to wrap things up. But first, I have a recommendation for us for next time.
Ooh.
Okay, so, there's a little bit of a story, so I'll explain. There is a manga that has been airing recently that has gotten a lot of attention. And so out of curiosity, I checked it out. And then out of curiosity from there, I thought, did this actually have a manga? Because I've never heard of this before, before this anime came out. And it turns out there is a manga. And then I thought, has anyone suggested it?
Are we about to do what I think we're about to do, Nick?
We might be. So then I was like, has anyone suggested we read this manga? And so I looked through our email, and yes, one person, even before the anime came out, actually suggested we check it out back in February. And I was like, that's good enough for me.
Does this
involve
ice skates?
No,
okay.
Actually.
Phew.
Not that one. The one that's been making waves for a different kind of... Well... Okay, we're gonna do Keijo, the one that features women in swimsuits trying to knock each other off of platforms in the middle of a pool, using only their asses and tits.
Yes! It's been so long since we've read a sports manga! Alright!
So, fuck it.
You know what? It's a good way to start kicking off the end of the year. Maybe we'll do
Yuri on Ice afterwards.
That's what we do. I would like to note, guys, December's coming up, and we have some cool things planned for December. Before I even get to that, though, first and foremost, this is the last week, then. We're going to be recording our bonus pod for this month sometime very soon. So if you have any recommendations, any series or chapters that you want to suggest for us to do for the Weekly Manga Recap Lives All-Star Edition, you can pick any chapter from any of the series we've done on the recap for. Any of them are viable. Just send us their suggestions, and we'll try to fit those in there. Also, if you want to send anything, Annalise is putting together that care package for Ashihara-sensei. If you want to send him anything, a letter wishing him to get well, fan art, just a letter saying how much you've appreciated his work. What the fuck, Infamous Planet is linking fucking butts in chat. I need to take away your moderator privileges. If you want to send anything to that, remember that the last chance you have to do it is coming up. I believe it's Thursday of next week, so... If you want to send something in, just contact Annalise on Twitter, @Kaito_Ace. That's K-A-I-T-O-U underscore Ace, A-C-E. Just send her a message, and she'll be more than happy to help you get something over to Ashihara-sensei. I know she's trying to put a big box together. So please, as fans of Weekly Manga Recap, I like to hope that a lot of you guys out there are fans of World Trigger. It would mean a lot if the Weekly Manga Recap community as a whole could put together a lot of stuff to kind of help Ashihara-sensei in this moment, because... I have to imagine for somebody to be working on a series as much as he clearly loves as much as he is, to be unable to do it because of a sickness or an illness, it's got to be a tough time for him. So anything you can give would definitely be appreciated.
We've gotten a lot of information about the series recently. It's really closely. He worked closely even with the anime team. He apparently has a general idea of how the entire go. Which is more than can be said of many mangaka out there.
Absolutely.
So, yeah, I mean, he works really hard to show him a sign of our affection, I think.
Yes, so anything you want to do, just contact Annalise and we'll do that. And then for stuff coming up in December you might want to start looking forward to, I try to make it so December's like a month we kind of give back in a way. I think we'll have some fun, like, stuff planned as like some of our bonus pods or things like that, but in addition, I'm just gonna tease, so throw out there, consider as you want, maybe another World Trigger to my heart and back door might pop out there, who knows, maybe not, but we might also have some ways for you guys to like win some manga, or we may be doing something related to a charity drive or something like that. We haven't fully cemented out all of our ideas, but there's definitely some stuff in the works that you guys are definitely going to be interested in checking out. So that's in December.
All right. And I guess we'll just sign off. Be sure to check us out on hitbox.tv/Rolo through standard time. Follow us on Twitter to stay updated on when exactly we're going to start the show @WMRPodcast, @RoloT, @YRoloTime. Check out our past episodes on podbean.com. Subscribe to us on iTunes. Leave a comment and rating on there. Subscribe to us on YouTube. Leave a like on there, and yeah, we appreciate all that feedback.
All I want for Christmas, Nick, is more iTunes reviews. And my birthday too, it's coming up, guys. You know what you can give me for my birthday? A 5-star review on iTunes.
If you want to provide feedback on our episode, ask us questions, suggest future manga read, you can do that by sending us an email, weeklymangarecap@yahoo.com. Special thanks go out to our Patreon supporters. If you want to give back a little bit more to the show, you can become a supporter. You get access to the bonus episodes that we do each month, including, of course, that super special Week of Mark Lives that Chris mentioned. And, yeah.
Yes, a special thank you to Matthew Anderson and Michael Taylor, who are our newest patrons. Thank you, guys. It is greatly appreciated. Brofist for helping out. And I hope you... enjoy the stuff you get, and thank you for supporting, because it's what helps us make a lot of these really awesome things possible.
Special thanks to Steam Air Tyocrass, who I'm sure is absolutely no fun whatsoever doing a Tyocrass for us, and to Infamous Planet, who posted button gifts in the chat just now. But he made this special frame for us stuff, and he does other stuff to help us.
He's mentioned before that he's fallen out of reading manga as much, so he doesn't always listen to Weekly Manga Recap. So I've noticed him in the chat room commenting on these things, like, what's Red Sprite? Oi, what's all this they're talking about? And I like how he stayed through here. I feel like solely so he could post wacky and stupid gifs in the chat like that butt one a moment ago. Like, he's just like, oh, this is my purpose, it is, pip, pip. Yeah, there it is. Another one. Boom. He says this at the ready.
All right.
Yeah, that's going to do it, guys. Thank you all for watching this week. For those of you who are listening live, I hope you, if you're American, enjoy your upcoming Thanksgiving holiday. Make sure that you have fun with your family. Enjoy your company. Try to keep the topics on the table lighthearted and fun. Talk about what... Bring up your how your feelings on Toriko were. Like, you know, everyone at the table is like, what the fuck's a Toriko? And you're just like, no, you guys don't get it. There were guns in space.
It's all about eating around the same table.
but there are guns in space. Just enjoy yourselves. Have a happy, safe holiday, safe travels. And for those of you who are not American, you know, get good. Get on our level, scrubs. What do you want me to do about it?
Enjoy your bank holiday, I guess.
Yeah, losers.